Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode number 13. And we got a good show tonight, folks, I'll tell you that. So let's get it out of the way. I got my co-host here with me tonight, David Bix and Span. Bix, how's it going?
I'm doing okay.
Awesome, awesome. And our other guest tonight, a distinguished guest at that, a man who has been on the newsletter scene for how long now?
This month is my 25th anniversary.
So, that's what I was thinking, 25 years.
If you go to pwtorch.com, Wade has been featuring one column per year. I think there's, I don't know, maybe 10 of them up by now, but you get a real sense of all the stuff, a taste of how I write and all the things that I've written over the years. I hope people will take advantage of that. And it's worth saying, too, The Torch website has just gone through a major improvement, a major redesign. And if you're a Torch VIP member, you go to torch.com/VIP. And if you're not, you can go to pwtorch.com/VIP. I always screw it up. And then pwtorch.com. Lots more accessibility, a lot easier to navigate. And then just, you know, Wade has been doing the Torch for 27, 28 years now. And the vast majority of that material is up and easy to find, easy to search. All the, you know, the Bruce Mitchell audio shows, all the Wade Keller daily updates and the Torch Talk audios and the Torch Talk transcripts are all there. But I really just spent a day or so looking at it myself this weekend, so I hope everybody takes advantage of that. I know it's a blatant plug, and I did it right off the bat, but
I did want
to do it. So,
and let me tell you this, you know, if of course the man whose voice you just heard, if you didn't already know, is the man Bruce Mitchell, senior columnist
for the Torch. Actually,
but anyway,
oh God, you're still plugging me. I'm sorry, cut all that out. We'll do it later.
No, that's great. That's great because. All that stuff being on there has become a huge assistance to us on this show. And it's been a great job that's been done revamping that site. And, yeah, definitely props to Wade and everybody over there for doing that. So, yeah.
It's such a cool selection of stuff between just all the newsletters, all the Torch Talk audios, and now that – Wade keeps getting those the old radio shows from John and Rezzy too, which of course have a near and dear place to my heart.
Yeah, fantastic stuff, no doubt. Well, we're here tonight to talk about a pretty important week in wrestling. We're talking about the week of October 13th through the 19th, 1986. And the big story of the week, of course, was the tragic car accident from Terry Allen, a.k.a. Mad MTA, and that's one of the main reasons why Bruce is on this show, because when we were talking about doing this week, the first person that came to mind was Bruce Mitchell, and because Bruce is from the area, and he lived it, and he knows all about it. But before we, you know, get his take on the whole subject, quick rundown of what went on. As about 2:40 in the morning on October 14th, 27-year-old Terry Allen, a.k.a. Mad MTA, crashed his $53,000 Porsche 911 Turbo after skidding down a slick road en route to his home in Matthews, North Carolina, from Charlotte, North Carolina, as he hit a utility pole, forcing him to hit the ceiling of his car at a high impact, causing him to fracture the vertebrae in his neck. Allen was returning home from a night at Bennigan's, which was a popular night spot for the wrestlers in Charlotte, but he had not been drinking, so he wasn't drunk. But the Charlotte police stated that Allen was going 55 miles per hour on a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, which caused him to lose control of his car as he was going down a rainy, slick road. The wreck took place about 6 miles or more away from Bennigan's. Allen was alert when Charlotte police officer J.M. Tegeler arrived at the scene on Sardis Road, with Allen pleading with him, "I need to get some help." Within minutes, Pete DeVoe and two of the EMTs arrived with the Charlotte Fire Department and the life-saving crew not too far behind. Allen started complaining of a tingling sensation in his body, and that he couldn't feel anything past his nipples as he was slumped to the rim, not able to move. Slumped to the steering wheel, excuse me. As Allen, being 6'3", 235 pounds, it made him so big in such a small car that he was trapped inside, and the workers wanted to make sure that he got out without jarring his spine, so they put a cervical collar around his massive neck. The life-saving crew had to use an air chisel to open up the driver's door as the EMTs administered chemicals intravenously to stabilize his blood pressure. While this is going on, other rescuers use the hydraulic cutter to peel the top off of the car and the jaws of life to hook the hook to yank away the steering wheel. The rescue workers then position themselves around Alan and strapped him onto a semi-rigid piece of equipment to immobilize his spinal cord. All in all, it took 51 minutes to remove Alan from his car, with the amazing part in all of this being that Alan never lost consciousness throughout and remained calm as they got him out of the car, which impressed everyone at the scene. About 3:30 a.m., the rescue workers lifted Alan onto a stretcher and they cut off his jeans so they could dress him in a pair of mass trousers, which could inflate to maintain his blood pressure. Alan then underwent surgery for 3.5 hours on October 15th, where they took bone from his pelvis to reconstruct his vertebrae and was rendered basically paralyzed from the nipples down and in critical condition on life support. As the day went on, fans were telephoning the hospital like crazy. And by 2 p.m., the hospital's PR department said they had received over 1,000 calls from fans in tears, with that number ballooning to over 10,000 by the next 48 hours. And as time wore on, he received over 40,000 letters from fans. There were also close to 400 girls at the hospital the day of the surgery, crying and praying for the hero to pull through. Fans also flocked by the dozens to Hunter Auto and Record Service in Charlotte to look at his total Porsche, with the owner, Helen Hunter, saying they seemed so concerned. Alan would regain movement in his left side on October 17th, and on October 24th, he was able to regain the movement in his right leg with his best friend and mentor, Dusty Rose, by his side. Dusty would say afterwards that there was no way in hell, that's his words, Alan wouldn't walk out of that hospital, and that he would return to the ring one day, even if he had to carry him there. Alan would get off the respirator on November the 4th, and it was around this time that he started working with therapists to regain more movement in his body. Alan would finally stand up for the first time on January 12, 1987 at the Charlotte Rehabilitation Hospital and walk for the first time on January 19th. Now, Bruce, yeah, this was a huge blow to Jim Crockett Promotions at a time period when they were, you know, peaking. I mean, they had just come off a big Great American Bash tour. Magnum is, you know, the number two guy behind Dusty on the babyface side, about to become number one. Like I said, you were around at the time. What do you remember about this horrible accident?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is what I remember at the time. And I had no insider knowledge, but I was definitely a big wrestling fan, going to as many shows as I could. I graduated college a couple of years before, and I worked in a small town in North Carolina, about 30 minutes away from Raleigh. So this was the first news story in North Carolina for wrestling that got major traction. And I think it was a shock to the media as to how popular wrestling was and how big it had gotten. And it had gotten big in the Carolinas in the last, this is 86, so the last 10 years. But it still, there would be, you know, before Thanksgiving show, the Greensboro paper, Greensboro Daily News and Record might run something or, you know, kind of patronize it a little bit. And there was always very tiny results things. But this was, I think, because there were so many phone calls to the hospital. There were so many phone calls to local news stations. It took a day or two. It was very similar to when David Von Erich passed away in Texas and the Texas media, local Dallas media got taken by surprise by the reaction to his death. And this was there too. And the situation was very serious. I mean, I think it sounds serious when you're talking about it, but you know he recovered a little bit from it. But they weren't sure he was going to move at all. And he was placed in kind of an iron lung contraction to keep him alive, and he was looking face down at the floor. They couldn't move him, and no one knew whether he was going to live or die first, and then whether he was going to move. And, you know, the culture was different, and they were able to keep some secrets about it because they very much for years wanted to keep fans hopeful that not only would Magnum TA walk out of the hospital someday, but that he would wrestle again. And they kept that very quiet, how he was doing. And, you know, when you finally saw him, you could speculate on it, but you really didn't know. But it was something, it was a shock to, like, turn on. And this was a time when, you know, you got your news at 6 o'clock on the local news, there wasn't something to watch all day long. There was, you know, you hear this with people, but it's like there was no internet. There was no way to get news before that. So you turn on the news and they encapsulate everything in the community in 30 minutes. And most people watched, you know, the ABC, CBS or NBC affiliate, and that was it. And they all led with this. Or it was the second story on the news, and it was because of the fans' reaction to it. But when you think of Magnum TA, he has this accident. He runs into this telephone pole. Number one, people run into telephone poles every day, and they don't fall down. And number two, it fell. It had to fall perfectly in the worst way. It could have fallen to the side, a few inches to the side, to the right, a few inches to the side, to the left. But it came straight down and hit him on the top of the head, you know, it hit the car and it hit him on the top of the head where it broke his neck exactly in that way. And so he's an amazing story. He's an amazing positive story to me in professional wrestling history because while he hung on to wrestling for a while, if you talk to him today, and I've had the opportunity to do that, and I've seen him talk to people at Greg Price's NWA Legends Fan Fest and that run in Charlotte, be running in Myrtle Beach in March, the annual one. He became very much about what's my future? What can I do to help my family? Wrestling is over. And he got into the cell phone tower business. He got into the cell tower business for many years and became really successful at it. And, you know, you're talking about a 27 years old and at the height of where your earning potential is going to come. And you've got women after you. You've got, you know, you're in a hot wrestling promotion. And he was known for having an ego back then. He and Dusty Rhodes were the two that were really known for not the nicest to the fans. You know, kind of the heroes on television and maybe not the greatest people behind the scenes. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure in being that hero all the time. But he really is an example of, you know, you think of the wrestlers who had their health or had most of their health and reacted poorly to the end of their fame. But this guy really stayed positive and made something through hard work out of his life afterwards. And, you know, the amazing story of him and Tully Blanchard, you know, kind of belies all that.
Now, when he returned to the Crockett Cup, as a fan at the time, what kind of emotions were you feeling seeing him back in the ring in the condition he was in?
Well, if you he made his return in Greensboro, and the angle was that Tully Blanchard and the Four Horsemen put up $100,000, and Dusty Rhodes put up $100,000. Tully Blanchard had just beaten Dusty Rhodes for the national title, and so Tully was going to defend the national title, but Dusty had to put up the $100,000, and J.J. Dillon would hold $100,000 in a Halliburton suitcase for Tully Blanchard, and Magnum T.A. would hold in a paper sack because, you know, working man taking his, you know, Dusty Rhodes was going to work, so he was taking his lunch to work in a sack. And as it happened, my friends and I were front row for that match in Greensboro. You hadn't seen Magnum TA come out. We were all Four Horsemen fans. We hated Dusty Rhodes, and you know, but it was tongue in cheek hatred, if you know what I mean. We knew what the deal was, and so Magnum came out. He got some cheers. He had been a target of ours, and I actually watched my friend John Hitchcock talk to him about this last summer, and Magnum laughing about, you know, Magnum had the best sense of humor about it back then, but now he does. And so he came out, and of course we were happy to see him. You know he's a performer, you know what the deal is. And but he was coming, he was walking gingerly, and clearly he had one arm in a cast, and clearly it wasn't moving, and he had lost a lot of weight. And as it happened, you know, of course, this turned into a big angle. And I thought we were in trouble because I always felt like sitting front row, the only, you know, one of the few groups of heel fans in the 10,000, you know, with 10,000 people there, when the good guys were kicking the bad guys' ass, we were going to take more crap. If the bad guys won cheated and won, then people were mad about it, but they were going to leave us alone a little more. And I just thought, this is going to be a long evening. Because to me, clearly, Magnum TA making his first appearance in a wrestling show since the accident, Dusty Rhodes is going to kill Tully Blanchard, and everybody's going to go home happy, and, you know, we're going to take a lot of crap. And so, but, you know, it's the nature of life. Well, what they did was that Dusty did beat the hell out of Tully, like he usually did anyway, and then beat Tully with his own famous finisher, the slingshot suplex, and we're sitting there going, oh my God. So it's one, Tommy Young goes, 1, 2, 3, it's over. They jump up, everybody's happy, except us. And then one beat later, Tully Blanchard, after the three count, puts his foot under the ropes, which causes like six grown men to start screaming at Tommy Young, hey Tommy, Tully's foot's under the rope, start the matchup. And Tommy Young is so smart and so canny. You know, this is the finish. It's not like we changed the finish. But he's so smart, he looks at us and goes, he did. And he looks at his foot and he looks at his foot disgustedly going, damn, now I got to start the matchup. Well, at that moment – JJ comes around the corner with his Halliburton briefcase or whatever he had, and grabs the paper bag from just came out of this traumatic car wreck from Magnum TA, and Magnum can't defend himself. He's got a stick in his hand, but he catches him by surprise and grabs it and takes off. And while he takes off, this guy, because the fans are just coming up to ringside and coming up to the little barrier, and this guy's like pushing on me, and he goes, man, look, JJ's got the money. Someone should do something. He just stole $100,000. So I immediately turned babyface and went, you know what? You're right. Someone should do something about it. He goes, I'm going to go get it. And I went, yeah, you should. And he jumps the railing and takes off after JJ. Like, oh, my God, this is like hilarious. And so Tommy Young – so when JJ takes off, not only does Nutball Fan go chase JJ – Dusty Rhodes goes chase because he thinks he's won the match in the storyline, but in real life too. This is the last time I thought that Jim Crockett Promotions or worked wrestling was real, because this was just too much fun. So Dusty takes off after Magnum, and not after Magnum, after JJ, and because he thinks he's won the title, he's won the match, and then Tommy Young stands up like the weight of the world's on his shoulders and starts to count out Dusty Rhodes while the fans are screaming. Well, we're counting with him and laughing, and people are getting quieter and quieter, so you could hear us counting. And so then he counts them out, waves it off. The Four Horsemen have won the $100,000, and so we're just like, oh my God, this is like the greatest thing ever. Dusty Rhodes comes back to the ring, and when Dusty would – and it happened in Florida with Ron Bass on that turn too. But when Dusty, when heel fans hijacked his shows, he didn't like it. So he's coming to the ring cursing at us, which is like getting the Academy Award. It's like you could not make a group of people happier than Dusty than having Dusty at that time, this egomaniac. I mean, a great act and really important in the history of professional wrestling and a big draw and one of the great promos ever, but huge ego. And he's just swearing. He grabs the mic. He's mad at Tommy Young. He's mad at us. And he starts swearing on the mic. Now, back then, you didn't swear on the mic. He starts swearing, bring me back my GD money. And it's like, JJ Dillon, he's mad. And we're just slapping hands. It's the greatest thing ever. And I have a copy of this today. The show starts, the NWA, it was either Worldwide or NWA Pro, but the two syndicated shows that were like Monday Night Raw, they were hour apiece. They would run the major angles and have that. The show literally starts with me throwing Four Horsemen signs in the air.
Awesome.
And then it shows, like my friend Hoban Johnson putting his foot up on the railing, pointing at his foot, going, Tommy, Tully's foot's on the road. So, we had a, I mean, that was, and that led to a big show in Charlotte where, of course, Dusty and Magnum got the money back. And, you know, they did all this stuff. But if you watch that show, it does, you know, like I said, it does exist on the tape trading circuit. And I'm sure WWE has it. If you watch that show, they turn down – this is the first time I heard audio really get changed. And then they bleep out Dusty being angry, but you can tell how mad he is. I mean, you can just see, and there's like this, because it was 1986, there's this weird thing with it. So that's the story. I mean, yeah, I was right there when Magnum came back, and it seemed like it was going to be a long road, if ever, for him to return to the ring. And, you know, we did kind of greet him nicely too at a certain point. It was like, hey man, glad you're okay. So that was,
yeah.
That was glad you're up and, you know, up and running, but that was definitely a part of it. And, you know, Crockett was hot, but, and I know in your summary, the deal with replacing Magnum and Dusty were America's team, and they had a great feud with the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette over Baby Doll. And they had their matches with Arn Anderson and Ole Anderson. And, so to replace him with the communist Nikita Koloff, who had, you know, back when the Road Warriors body, when Hawk's body, you know, that badass, that's what people thought, you know, wrestling fans thought, that kind of steroided up body was what would kick ass. Was like the baddest, the toughest guys on the planet had that kind of body. It's not like today when people think Brock Lesnar is the baddest man on the planet. He has no type of body like that. But, you know, they really, you know, he was a communist. And people thought there hadn't been a communist Russian Cold War heel turned babyface. And Fritz von Erich did the Nazi thing and turned babyface, but it was because they knew he was, you know, they knew he was an SMU hero, football hero in Dallas, Texas, as Jack Atkinson. But no one had done that. So the shock of Dusty Rhodes coming out for a match with J.J. Dillon and Tully Blanchard, and then you see Nikita, I mean, this was really well booked, kind of holding back behind. And you're like, what's he doing? What's he doing? Is he walking out with Dusty? Is he not? And then the big moment was he gets into the cage like he's going to jump Dusty, because that's what everybody did. They all would team up and jump Dusty in the cage every chance they got. And he pauses, and then he goes after, not Tully Blanchard, but Ole Anderson and J.J. Dillon. That the Superpowers team of Dusty Rhodes and Nikita Koloff for about, I want to say, 9 months to a year was really hot. It was like they were doing big business and people were behind that too, based on Nikita Koloff saying, I respect Magnum TA because he was the last opponent Magnum TA had. And they just had that best of seven series for the U.S. title. And people wanted to see, you know, the big bully badass on their side. And that worked. But it was 86 when they were really doing well. 87, it started to slow down a little bit. And 88 was when the wheels started falling off for the Crockett's.
Yeah, I'll say that for sure. Now, Biggs, one thing that we got to give Dusty credit for is he always kept Magnum employed. You know, when Magnum came back, he was, you know, an announcer with Jim Ross on UWF television. He eventually, you know, started doing more stuff, you know, once UWF went under and working with regular JCP shows. And then, you know, he got work after Dusty left working with Turner for a few years. So what did you think of Magnum as an announcer? And did you appreciate the fact that Dusty, you know, took care of him?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think people did. I think there was this idea. There was a bigger thing at play, too. It was Jim Crockett Promotions versus the WWF. I mean, it was clear that was where the battle was going to be. So not only, you know, our wrestling was better than your wrestling, whether you were living in the Northeast or whether you're living in Los Angeles and thought that of WWF, or whether you were in Baltimore, Philadelphia, or in the Southeast with Jim Crockett Promotions, and whatever it was, and all across the country, like, you know, the battle lines were laid out. So yeah, I thought that was a good thing. You wanted to see Magnum do well. He was part of the fraternity, but he was okay as an announcer. I mean, he's a smart guy, and he kind of knew how to play it. But it also, there was something where you wanted to see him in the ring, and he wasn't going to be in the ring. And that wasn't great. But, you know, Dusty was loyal to the guys, to his crew, in particular, that was loyal to him. And, you know, I think the part you says in your summary, you had something where I think it's really you know, important or true. I don't know how true it was, but, you know, Magnum was the number two babyface, and they've always said that he was going to be their Stone Cold Steve Austin or their Hulk Hogan, the Crockett's Stone Cold Steve Austin and Hulk Hogan. And just watching it week to week and year to year with Dusty Rhodes on top, I don't believe that. I think that Dusty Rhodes was going to be the number one babyface forever. And that wherever the promotion went, I mean, it went downhill, and it did go downhill. He was going to do everything he could to keep it running with him on top. He was not best friend, whatever. He was not going to, you know, he wanted that guy running with him. He wanted Tonto to the Lone Ranger, but he wasn't going to give that up. There wasn't any sign of that. And then I think Magnum would have gotten a run as NWA champion. He would have beaten Ric Flair, but I think Ric Flair would have gotten that title back because the formula of the promotion was the chase, and the best person to chase was Ric Flair. And Magnum TA, like when Kerry Von Erich won the title, when Dusty Rhodes would win the title, then the story's over. And the way, you know, it was always about the chase. When the chase is over, that's it. And so I don't know. I don't believe that I believe that Magnum would have been a very important part of that. He had showed a lot of fire. He was, you know, he was a very good meat and potatoes babyface promo. But for me as a fan, I didn't think he was as good as the guy he replaced. And the guy he replaced was kind of pushed out by Dusty Rhodes, and that was Ricky Steamboat. I thought Ricky Steamboat was better, and I kind of held that against Magnum a little bit watching it. And you know, the guys that were the best wrestlers in Jim Crockett Promotions, the best workers in the ring, were all the heels that flew around for the baby faces. And so Magnum – but I will say this. I mean, I learned if Magnum and Tully Blanchard were on the card, go to that card. You know, if Ric Flair was on the card, go to that card. But if Magnum TA and Tully Blanchard were on the show, you wanted to see that because they were going to have a big fight. And they were going to go all over the arena, and it was going to be really good.
As far as, like, the announcing, like, maybe – not at first. The UWF stuff, I don't think he was that good. But I think he's better than he gets credit for as far as, like, later on, the little bit he did, like, in 89 and stuff. And then I was going to say, like, as far as – you know, we're talking about it. You were talking about, like, his wrestling a little bit and with Steamboat. Like, it's a very different archetype of babyface, though. And I do think – I mean, maybe
yeah,
now he's a, maybe now he starts to get more credit for his work. But I think for a long time, Magnum – did not get enough credit for how good he was. That, I mean, if you think about the stuff with, not just the stuff with Tully, but the stuff with DiBiase in Mid-South, the stuff with Mr. Wrestling 2 against the Midnight Express and against Butch Reed and Jim Neidhart in Mid-South, all, you know, all that type of stuff. I mean, he rarely had bad, at least, you know, the stuff that's on tape. I mean, you saw him every week, but I mean, the stuff that's on tape, like,
no, he was good.
I mean, he was
him,
really
him and Arn Anderson, whoever it was. I mean, he was good. I mean, no doubt. I mean, and the story that was told with Mr. Wrestling 2 in Mid-South was just tremendously well done. And he played the role of the earnest, but, you know, earnest, respectful student who's been pushed to the limit by a coach who stabbed him in the back. I mean, he did a great job with that. And he you know, he could wrestle. I mean, he could go. He was one of those performers. Ronnie Garvin's a different. It was different than he was, but he was like Ronnie Garvin in this sense. He knew what he could do, and he did it well. But he didn't do much else. And he, you know, of the baby faces in Crockett Promotions, this is where they got hurt some too, by replacing with Nikita, who was so limited whether he was the muscle head or the bush top Nikita Koloff that's not such a muscle head. You know, Ricky Morton was the best worker of the baby faces all along, and then Magnum was probably second. Dusty was different, but he could, you know, he I would just say, and this is not an insult, he was good. That's how I categorize him. He was good.
Now, Chris
in the ring.
Chris in Atlanta, did the accident get picked up mainstream at all?
Yeah, I remember that the AJC covered it. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, in the Carolinas or anything, but it did get covered in the AJC. I don't ever remember the television news doing it. And what's funny about that is that on October 18th, 1986, the first day of television, you know, after the accident on the syndicated television, there was little discussion about the wreck, and the shows went on as business as usual, with him still being part of the show, as they showed the angle where Tully had his knee injured by Dusty in Greensboro on October 12th, where Tully afterwards vowed revenge on Dusty and Magnum, who stood at ringside. And this all led up to the legendary angle where Ole and Arn Anderson, along with J.J. Dillon, followed Dusty Rhodes to the JCP offices in Charlotte, where they assaulted Dusty with the baseball bat, and Dusty yelling out, "Make it good," which has been misconstrued for many years, but was finally confirmed by Arn Anderson on the WWE Network during the Dusty Rhodes tribute, as he said it was an homage to an old Western film.
John Wayne.
Yeah, John Wayne.
That's John Wayne. That's John
Wayne.
Yeah.
And everybody for years was thinking that Dusty said that because, you know, he wanted, as the booker said, make it look good. But no, it was a line from a film.
Now, I will say this. I always thought it was make it good. He's a tough. You're going to break my arm. You know, make it good. You no good. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I took it like that when I was watching
it
at the time.
Because a lot of people
it's
did.
Worse, yeah. Oh, I know. I know. It's worth saying, you know, it's worth saying technology was different back then. And, you know, they faced, you know, they would literally mail the VCR tapes. They bicycled the tapes and they would send them. And it was a lot harder to, you know, today you just drop in, you know, something on the show and you can get it on. And sometimes you wonder why they don't even in 2015 with WWE. But the idea that they could have broken into the programming, they really faced a choice. I'm sure they weren't thinking about that. The wrestlers were all, you know, waiting in the waiting room in Charlotte. They were, you know, they were all concerned with that. And, you know, they're all concerned with Magnum living and dying. And, you know, financially, what was he going to do and how they could support him that way, too. I think they, you know, I think they kicked back some of their money to him. And
yes,
they
did. It was, it was actually Cornette explained it in the Midnight Express scrapbook that it was every single wrestler that got a regular paycheck from the promotion, you know, so including the job, including the, you know, I guess, what would you call it then? The job guys who work the house shows. So the prelim guys then.
Enhancement talent.
And, well, there are two different levels of enhancement talent is what I'm saying. So everyone, kicked in $25 a week and Crockett and the Crockett office matched it. So it was $25 per wrestler per week and then matched by Crockett.
And that was a good deal for them to do.
My point being is I don't think the television show was a priority at that point, and they didn't know, you know, they had to sit down and make those decisions. And Dusty Rhodes, I mean, you know, you have to feel for Dusty Rhodes in this. The booker, he's having to make a decision about replacing his best friend who may die. You know, who's going through this, all the emotions and, you know, or maybe paralyzed for life at the peak of his physical prime. And what to do, and he came up with a very creative, nobody saw it coming type of decision. And he didn't find somebody from another promotion and bring them in, and he got somebody completely different from Magnum that still, you know, paid tribute to Magnum without exploiting him. And I thought, you know, when I look back, Dusty Rhodes made a lot of great booking decisions in a very close amount of time, but, you know, that crisis management, I never, you know. You know, you saw it on the news, and then you went that Saturday, and, you know, I'd work on Saturdays, but I always had my VCR set and the tape in there ready to tape like every wrestling, you know, all these syndicated wrestling shows that were on UHF stations at the time. And you wanted to see, okay, how are they going to handle this? And you kind of went, oh, they didn't even say anything about it. But it was just, you know, and it was a certain amount of disappointment, but, you know, and they never really – they didn't do a WWE-style – tribute show to Magnum TA. They went on, they acknowledged it and went on with it. But like I said, I think they really wanted to keep it secret that he was not, you know, I think they, in their heart of hearts, they wanted a miracle that he would come back to the ring, and they wanted to keep that possibility alive in the fans' minds. So they talked about it, they knew fans knew, but they also didn't play it up very much.
And I agree with that. I think that was actually probably a smart business move on their part.
Yeah.
You know, to do that. And like you talked about, you know, that night on October 18th, you know, everybody remembers the whole, you know, the Charlotte deal because that was on television. Well, it actually happened the day before in Philadelphia as Dusty, now needing to find the top babyface, had Nikita accompany him to the ring for his match against J.J. Dillon, who was subbing for the injured Tully Blanchard. Nikita fought with Ole Anderson at ringside most of the match and helped Dusty win in 57 seconds as he held Dillon up for Dusty to hit a bionic elbow off the top rope. Dusty was wearing a cast on his arm, selling the injury that was shown on television earlier that day, and got on the mic after the match saying, I quote, "Hey, Philly, tell Hulk Hogan that Dusty's in town tonight," unquote, which was in reference to the WWF show at the Spectrum that was across town that night. Now, the Crockett show drew 7,000 at the Civic Center, which is a strong number, but the WWF drew 16,000 at the Spectrum, which, you know, at this time period, Roddy Piper had just turned, and he was holding the Piper's Pit there at the Spectrum, so that was a pretty big draw.
Well, wasn't that also a Hogan-Orndorff show, too?
And Hogan and Orndorff as well in the main event.
Yeah, Philadelphia and Baltimore was where the Crocketts really made inroads, and there were times when they did outdraw them. They didn't on that, you know, they didn't on that night, but that was definitely there. And it's worth saying that match pretty much was done in Charlotte. They knew.
Yeah, same exact.
Same exact match, and they taped the one in Charlotte and showed it on the syndicated show. But the reason why J.J. Dillon was in the match and he took a crack across why they broke Dusty's arm and then Dusty took out J.J. Dillon was that J.J. was going to have surgery on his nose and on his face for some other reasons. And
he's talked about that. He said he got an eye lift or whatever.
I honestly have forgotten why. But then the next time he shows up on television, he's got these terrible bruises that look like Dusty cracked him across his face with with that cast for real. And so that stuff was going on at the same time. So lots of lots of moving parts to all this.
It's funny, Chris, like until you mentioned they did it the night before in Philly. Like when I'm looking at this first, I'm thinking, I didn't realize it was in Philly. It didn't look like the Civic Center. And then you said that. I was like, oh.
No, the one you can find on TV was definitely Charlotte Coliseum.
And yeah,
I never knew until you read that. I never knew they did it. I'm not shocked, but I never knew they did the exact same thing in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and Nikita worked earlier that night as a heel. He teamed up with Ivan and Crusher, and they beat Jimmy Valiant, Dick Murdoch, and Wahoo McDaniel. So, he worked at the heel early in the night.
You know, one of the things, you talk about the change in Jim Crockett Promotions because of Magnum being taken off the chessboard and then Magnum TA's career ending. Another person the person who suffered the most career-wise from this that remained an active wrestler was Ivan Koloff. Because Ivan Koloff was real, you know, as the coach, as Uncle Ivan, at a point in his career where he was, you know, he was moving, you know, downhill and down the card a little bit, mentoring Nikita Koloff and turning him into a credible act and teaching him how to wrestle on the road and then having him there, he was set for years in that role. As long as the Cold War could no one knew the Cold War was going to end, but as long as the Cold War could continue, the tensions with Russia, he was going to be all right, you know. And there was Crusher Khrushchev too, but you changed Nikita, he went down the card, and they got the immortal Vladimir Pietro, Al Blake, another heavy lifting bouncer out of Minneapolis to replace him. But apparently, we remember going, oh, this guy looks great. You know, this guy's going to be a badass too. And then he moved like he was walking in cement. I remember seeing him in live and just going, oh boy, this isn't, you know, he had a good look, but it was like, this isn't working. And then apparently he had another career in the distribution field. And he got, he spent some time in a pokey, and that was the end of that. And Ivan never got that, Ivan never got that that partner to get back up the card, and so his money was definitely hit hard, and it never came back.
Although I would say, I think, yeah, I mean, you can tie it to that too. But also, I mean, if you look, the next year or so was really when Ivan started to break down physically too.
Yeah.
So I think it kind of would have happened anyway.
Well, I mean, maybe he would have, you know, if he'd had Nikita, and let's say the other part is Nikita had kept his body. Nikita, you know, Nikita's wife got sick and passed away from cancer because of that. He made some health decisions that probably have helped him for the rest of his life. But if he'd have kept that body and stayed over as a heel, then Ivan could have been the talking manager and not the wrestler in the ring so much. I think he would have done better. But yeah, he was beginning to break down then. And you know, it's something with Ivan Koloff, because of the nature of technology, and then being on the on WTBS when it was. I mean, he was on WTBS for Georgia Championship Wrestling when it was as a. You know, teaming with Ole Anderson when it was a huge rating, when it was drawing huge ratings and more people watching as a national promotion than anything else. But his time when Crockett Promotions was hot as Uncle Ivan, people remember that. But he very much was the quintessential Cold War Russian villain. And worked every great, you know, worked at the top of cards with every great babyface of that time. And really was a great, you know, just this tank that could not be stopped. I always think it helped his career as, you know, people remember his Uncle Ivan, but I think he's remembered more because of technology for the end of his career than he is for all that major time he was drawing those big houses as a big time heel.
And then Ivan, of course, you know, that next year went on to become a member of Paul Jones's army. He teamed up with Manny Fernandez and stuff like that. But Nikita's 1997 was interesting too, because yeah, he was with Dusty. He got, you know, he was feuding with Luger, but he had injury issues, and he started going down the card a little bit as well. You know, as 1987 went on, of course, 1988, you know, we had this the health issues and other stuff.
Some of the, you know, there was an attrition in the talent roster that Dusty really was, and Jim Crockett, they did not want to address. And frankly, you know, as great as some of they were kind of in that situation of, you've got some great wrestlers, some great acts. It's sort of like Randy Orton today. It's like they're great acts, but they could use a time away. The talent roster could use some freshening up. And when they've got the UWF talent roster or a good chunk of it, they wanted to prove that they were, you know, there was this competitiveness. We have the better roster. And they killed, you know, Dusty killed Terry Taylor and those guys off, and didn't make use of Dr. Death and didn't keep Gordy and Terry Gordy and lost DiBiase right off the bat, Ted DiBiase to the Million Dollar Man thing. So, you know, you look at that and go, the Crocketts were really peaking and really running fast with Dusty. And then Dusty was getting older too and not moving as much. And you know, there was a natural rivalry with Ric Flair all along, particularly for those of us who were, you know, had watched Ric Flair become this great star and then become the hometown hero. And then Dusty just comes and shoves him to the side, makes him the heel again. For a lot of people, it was like Ric Flair can talk just as well as Dusty can, if not better, and is cooler and a much better wrestler. Why isn't he given his shot? And, that was all those things were there with 87 and 88, and it really started kind of going downhill. But they could have used Magnum TA, you know, clearly might have helped a lot.
Totally.
You know.
Now, also on October 18th, we've mentioned Paul Jones' Army. We've mentioned Cold War Heels. Baron Von Raschke turns babyface as he's left the Paul Jones' Army, becoming one of Jimmy Valiant's friends, as he was kicked twice by accident by teammates in a six-man match, Rick Rude and Shaska Watley, against Brad Armstrong and the Kansas Jayhawks, Dutch Mantel and Bobby Jaggers, and Raschke was pinned. And, of course, Jones was blamed him for the loss, and then he back-jumped him, and Baron came back with the claw hold until the Army attacked him. David, this is Baron von Raschke's babyface is always funny, but the Paul Jones Army at this time, Rick Rude, you know, that's the name that always is interesting, you know, to see in this time period in Crockett. What do you think about the makeup of the Paul Jones Army in that time period, Dave?
Well, Manny Fernandez and Rick Rude stick out, like, I don't want to say like a sore thumb because that sounds like a negative, but they don't fit in, certainly, and they really, I don't get why they were with Paul Jones' army in the first place, because I mean they were a really good team. And this is really when Rude starts to stand out as being a good worker and all that. So it was just weird. I mean, I like Pez Watley. I can get a kick out of Jimmy Valiant feuding with them, but and obviously Bruce can attest to this. I mean, this was just where they kind of just sent guys to just kind of, well, what was the story? What was the story I heard recently? It was the Dusty. What was the whole? I forget. I'm trying to remember the whole thing with how the whole Paul Jones army versus Jimmy Valiant thing came. What was it that Valiant was an office dude, or that he was just a favorite of the Crockett's? So we knew he had to keep them. But Dusty just kind of buried him in that feud. It was something like that, right?
Well, here's the deal. The key guy is Jimmy Valiant. Jimmy Valiant had a real following. He was the king of the B shows. In other words, the headliners, Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, and even before that, Ric Flair and Steamboat, or Steamboat and Youngblood, whoever it was, the big headliners went to the big auditoriums. Went to the Charlotte headline, those shows, Richmond, Norfolk, all that stuff, and Asheville, and then Dorton Arena and Raleigh, which was kind of in between those two. Either they would bring in the Flair-led show, or they bring in Jimmy Valiant, because Jimmy Valiant could draw that street people thing. He drew street people. He drew, and I also learned real early on, don't go to Jimmy Valiant shows, even though I got a kick out of, a guilty pleasure is watching, going back on YouTube or wherever you want to go to see it, that feud, the Paul Jones Jimmy Valiant feud, because there's a bunch of head shaving going on. It actually makes sense. Paul Jones is like is campy in the best sense, where he's not meaning to be campy, but he acts like a child who's, every time Jimmy Valiant crosses him, he acts like a child who's had his popsicle swiped from him. I mean, he starts waving his arms around. He makes these big faces and all this crap. And so anyway, but Valiant could draw from the hill, from the people from the small towns in the hills of Virginia. He could draw from the motorcycle types. He drew a real rural fan, and they were loyal to him. And he could headline a house and make them money. And the Paul Jones, and one time they put him on top of a show. The Boogeyman Jam in Greensboro. If you buy the WWE Legacy DVD with Rick Steamboat, there's an hour long match on it between Steamboat and Flair, which, those were classic matches of the day. But it wasn't the headline match, because with Ric Flair defending against Ricky Steamboat that had been promised. But the headline match was Jimmy Valiant versus Assassin Number Two, Hair versus Mask. Assassin Number Two being Hercules Hernandez. And they tried to put him on top one time, and it did all right. But they just knew that this, he drew a certain type of fan. And he did draw them, and they made money with these things. And Paul Jones was a long-standing, employee of Jim Crockett Promotions. He had been the number one good guy babyface in the 70s there with Wahoo McDaniel. And he had been loyal to them. He'd been loyal to Eddie Graham, and he kind of worked in the Georgia, Florida Crockett Promotions. And I'm sure he knew things and done favors for them. He was sort of like Mr. Fuji. In WWE, where Mr. Fuji, I don't care what the nostalgia is for that guy. When you're watching him as a manager, he was horrible. Paul Jones was not good as a manager. But he was promised a job for as long as there's Crockett Promotions, and they kept that promise. And so they put him in, they had Valiant feud with him when his injuries got, he was kind of like Ivan Koloff, kind of the same age, when his injuries got to be too much where he couldn't wrestle much anymore. And he was, he was a really good looking guy in his day. I mean, the legend is he slept with Jane Mansfield. If you don't know who Jane Mansfield is.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Yes. That he slept with Jane Mansfield. And if you don't know who that is, Google that and Google it with an image. She may have been the hottest woman in the last 100 years.
Mariska Hargitay's mother.
Yeah, Mariska Hargitay's mother. But and I do believe that happened. And he went to high school and slept with Janis Joplin.
I didn't know that one.
Yeah, so he was he was a stud in his day. I mean, you know, he was a good looking guy, you know, white meat baby face that women liked. And then he was instrumental in when he got just a little, you know, a touch too old for that. He passed that on to Ricky Steamboat in the famous when he turned on Ricky Steamboat, which is one of the great angles in Mid-Atlantic. But then he became the manager, and so they would stick the Barbarian, Shaska Wallace, kind of the oddballs, mid-card guys, and have them feud with Valiant, because Valiant would do those goofy interviews and talk about that's grandma's hometown, it's my birthday on the localized interviews. He was a trip, and he could do that stuff, and then have, you know, the Jimmy Valiant kind of brawl and bring it back, and they would do all right with that. But when you got put with him, like Tully Blanchard was punished for not mentioning Dusty Rhodes enough on his promos, so they put him with Jimmy Valiant for 3 or 4 months until he learned his lesson, and then he became one of the great ass-kissing heel promos of all time. You couldn't say Dusty Rhodes enough times after that, and so that was part of that. But Manny Fernandez, as talented as he is, was a problem. And Rick Rude was just rising up. So the idea was they finally were going to send Jimmy Valiant on his way, but they had to keep Paul Jones. So the idea was Manny Fernandez and Rick Rude as a tag team against the Rock and Roll Express would elevate Rick Rude. And Manny had worked with the Rock and Roll Express with Ricky Morton in Joe Blanchard's promotion in Texas. And so that would be a good thing. But Rick Rude was ready to make a bigger move than that. And you know, Manny Fernandez and Rick Rude hated Paul Jones for exactly what you would think, that, you know, he was an office guy. And they were not, you know, they weren't the most – none of these guys were well-behaved, and they weren't either. And so that, you know, they didn't like being with him. And Rick Rude, you know, Rick Rude started his national career really – by leaving that tag team as world tag team champions, and right as it happened, and then there was some tape that somehow they had a tape of an earlier match, and they passed it off as the Rock and Roll Express won it. But I think people look at – there's two teams in the 80s I think people look at and go, oh, boy, they were great teams. And that's Jimmy Snook and Terry Gordy in Georgia, and then Rick Rude and Manny Fernandez. But neither team was together long enough to be great. They were just – it was kind of like, oh, that would have been really fun. And, you know, Rick Rude was doing the leap off the cage at that point. He, you know, Manny Fernandez, as problematic as he was a great in-ring performer. But that was Rick Rude's graduation and pretty much the end of Manny Fernandez as a national star. Because after that, he just kind of faded out. He could just kind of faded out.
And now we go into the Universal Wrestling Federation, where Hacksaw Jim Duggan no-shows the October 19th Power Pro Wrestling TV tapings in Fort Worth, which was the inaugural Power Pro Wrestling tapings. And although nobody knew the exact reason, there were rumors going around hard that Duggan was considering jumping to the WWF. But Dave Meltzer was hearing that Duggan was thinking more and more about staying, which Dave said that with Duggan's return and one more key wrestler, the UWF could take over Jim Crockett Promotions slot as the number two promotion in the world by spring 1987. Meltzer did say, though, that the promotion doesn't plan on featuring Duggan in a top position until he commits to them. Now, Bruce, Duggan at this time period was, you know, the guy for Bill Watts. Although he was starting to go to Japan a little bit and stuff like that. But I think it made a lot of sense for him, though, to talk to Vince McMahon, because the rumblings were already there that there were going to be issues coming in that part of the country, you know, economical wise. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that he saw the writing on the wall. So what did you think about Duggan and his prospects and going to WWF?
Well, I didn't know about that at the time, but we were starting to get the UWF, and I love that stuff. I was a Freebirds guy, and you love Bill Watts and, you know, syndicated there. That stuff was really, you know, good, really well done. But you also, I've talked about this on Torch Audio, as a fan, WWF at that time was like the invasion of the body snatchers. I don't know if you know that movie. Because a guy would disappear, and then he would appear more as a pod person than what I thought was
real. Dick Slater at that time period is a perfect example of that.
Steamboat. I mean, there's a ton of guys that you're just kind of like going, this isn't the guy. He's not getting the promo time. He's not getting a program like I'd like him to have. He's dumbed down.
Even Coco Ware.
Yeah. Oh, of course, even Coco Ware. But yeah, it's like he's kind of a dumbed down version of what you get. He's holding holding an ice cream bar, and he's getting a 15-second Krylon promo, and there's not much more to him. And he's been taken out of some storyline on another show that I'm really digging. So it's like, you know, you just kind of cringe when that would happen. And so Jim Duggan, who was just this you know, badass. And a hero, you could see where that was, but also you could tell kind of watching that Watts's promotion, you know, and I learned later on a lot of it was because of the Japanese commitments of Dr. Dusty Williams and Ted DiBiase and Terry Gordy. Guys would be around a little bit, and then they'd be gone, and they'd be around, and they'd injure them, and they'd be back and forth, and you're just sitting there going, I think that was really tough, and you know, I used to think, well, Watts should have made the commitment to pay for the talent to keep them out of Japan and keep them in his promotion and make the most out of that, make the most money out of that. But it may not have been economically feasible. At the same time, they were clearly going national. There was an excitement to it. Jim Ross and Michael Hayes were a great color team. Eddie Gilbert was there. Sting was pretty cool. The other guy I didn't care about one way or the other. But Chris Adams and Terry Taylor were great. And Missy Hyatt was fun. And so, I mean, there was something, you know, they had talent, they had a good crew, and but you never were surprised to – it wasn't that I got a news – I started getting newsletters. I started getting the Wrestling Observer, which changed my life a few months after that. So, you know, I didn't know – you know, but you were never surprised to turn on your television. And for me, I just go, oh, no. You know, the only one I ever thought that really that got to be himself, and it wasn't forever, was Roddy Piper. Like Roddy Piper.
Oh yeah,
Roddy Piper got to be the Roddy Piper from Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, and the Roddy Piper, you know, the Roddy Piper that I'd never heard of, and walked out on Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, started blowing the bagpipes, and I thought, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And And the guy from, you know, the guy with Gordon Solie in Georgia Championship Wrestling, he got to be that, but he was about the only one. And
Randy Savage.
Yeah, Randy Savage, but I hadn't seen Randy Savage. Randy Savage for me was WWF create. I mean, he was, for me, I say that. You know, I'd read about him in the magazines, and then when I saw him, I was like, damn, he's really good. And he stood out, you know. I mean, he was just too good. But yeah, that's a good point. Randy Savage was definitely allowed to be Randy Savage, but there was that feeling. So I wouldn't have been surprised to see Jim Duggan, but it always seemed like sooner or later the guys you heard about were thinking about going to the WWF, which was a big issue. They ended up doing it. You know, they ended up making that deal. I look back at it now, going, Vince was paying more money. They were, you know, Hulk Hogan was generating more money at the top of the cards. It was a better, you know, the travel was hellacious, worse than even for Bill Watts. But there it was. But like Jim Duggan is a classic example because, you know, he worked hard in UWF and in Mid-South. And the second he left, he stopped working. He was a shadow of himself. I mean, he was. I mean, I hate using this word now because it's kind of disrespectful, and you don't see it very often in wrestling anymore. Everybody works so hard now, but he didn't work very hard. And you now look back and go, well, how could you work hard when the travel was the way it was? But he, you know, he became a lot less. You know, he became, I've got a 2x4 and an American flag, and that's all I need. And you didn't get anything out of him. You can go back and watch on that Mid-South collection that WWE put out, the match with him and Ted DiBiase in the cage with all the stipulations. I mean, he's busting his tail. It's a great match.
Now, Dave, we did the Death of UWF show, you know, months ago. And Duggan, you know, if he had been around when the buyout happened, that definitely would have changed a lot of it, in my opinion. You know, to have a key piece like Duggan. But it's also interesting to see, you know, Dave Meltzer talking about how if, you know, Duggan stays and add one more wrestler, that they could take over Crockett. That's a totally interesting mindset at the time. What do you think about those comments?
Well, there were some flaws that you could see in Jim Crockett Promotions. And to me, the flaw was Dusty on top so hard all the time. But it was still 86, so they were still doing well. You know, the fans who traded tapes, and I wasn't one of them at that point, fans who really were in the know, and I wasn't one of them at that point, I was sort of in the know, you know, Bill Watts carried a lot of weight. And there was this, you know, that he was the best booker because Dusty would start things and they'd be really cool, but they would never quite end. And then they would just go to something else. He would just drop stuff and it just go right to it. And he kept things hot. So for as long as that lasted, but Watts, like, things logically progressed and there was a lot of little detail work and made sense. And he kept, you know, he built the crescendos. And he got guys, you know, he got young talent over. So he had that young talent. And you could make an argument, you could make a really good argument that the last year of Watts's guys, UWF and going into UWF, that were featured on that show were every bit the talent that Dusty Rhodes and Crockett had, and maybe better. Maybe they added up to a better thing. So that new thing, and then he did the episode, he did better episodic television than Dusty did. And certainly
by that point.
Yeah, and certainly than WWF did. Although his was, you know, UWF is not quite as good, and it was because of that having to write guys in and out all the time to make their Japan tours, I thought.
Yeah. And I mean, I honestly, like, it would have been interesting to see that Duggan and Crockett, but I don't think he necessarily fits in as well as we always pictured Fantasy Book DiBiase as being. Like, I don't know if he's that great a fit. I mean, I'd want to see it, but
he would have been secondary to Dusty. I mean, it's if things had changed, you know, I always think that Ted DiBiase, I mean, you know, Fantasy Book, and I try to stay away from that stuff, but it's like, but Ted DiBiase maybe as a million-dollar man character kicking Ric Flair out of the Horseman might have been something really cool and really good. But then the problem was the elephant in the room, which was Dusty. So that, you know, like, you know, you had to, like, shake things up and get some things going around, really shoot some of that talent to the top that they got in the buyout. But, yeah, at the same time, you know, that's what, you know, Bill Watts says it and Jim Cornette say it and a lot of people that were there say it, that the oil economy at the time going crashing at the same time UWF is going national. And you had to go national. You couldn't sit there and be a sitting duck and have WWF and Crockett pick off your talent. You had to move. You had to play for the big stakes. You had to play – speaking of playing for the big stakes. You had to play for the big stakes. And, you know, but it was just, the timing was just so far off for that. And Duggan, you know, Duggan had a lucrative career in the WWF. I don't agree with him that arrest with the Iron Sheik meant that he never got the WWF title. I don't think he never seemed to me like be on that road, but, he was making, you know, that was a good place to be if you could keep your sanity.
Yeah. And one thing I did want to mention too, as far as, you know, we're talking about, this is the debut of Watts and UWF at the Cowtown Coliseum, right?
Yeah, Cowtown Coliseum.
For Power Pro Wrestling being turned into now a, like, more than just a B show, it's now kind of equal footing and all original matches and stuff. And it's like, I don't remember the first time I saw this, but it's like they got a little better. But that first show is embarrassingly dark and empty looking. Like, and they never, Dallas never meant nearly as much as Watts wanted it to either.
Yeah, he tried to take that territory, but he couldn't. He had the Birds, but you had to have the Von Erichs, and the Von Erichs were in disarray. I mean, it's just, you can't get, it's hard to, you know, it's kind of what's happening today, which is now everybody's home team promotion is WWE. And even though they stink in a lot of ways, it's hard to get people to watch, to really, you know, hard to get most fans to watch anything else or to get behind something else, whether it's good or bad, because the major, this major, you know, Major League in Dallas had Von Erichs. And if you didn't have him, you weren't Major League. And so, you know, maybe he would have been able to reestablish that, but it was that, you know, he was making a bold move, but he really would have been better off going to one of his mainstay areas and have a, you know, and have that hot crowd. You know, the Crockett's made that mistake too. When they would go, when they would go out of their mainstay areas, their TV wasn't as good. It didn't look as good. And they lost, you know, Starcade lost a lot of luster leaving Greensboro and Atlanta, particularly Greensboro.
Yeah, and I mean, I think with Watts, I get why he did that more than, say, Crockett going to Chicago for Starcade or something like that. Because, like, I kind of get what he's thinking. This is already sort of near my territory. It's a top market. If I can get that, that's a good foundation. I feel like that makes more sense than the whole.
And it was a big travel market, too. You could travel in and out of there. I mean, that was the Crocketts wasted a lot of money doing that, too.
And it was Kim Mantell wanting to stick it to the Von Erichs.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Kim Mantell's booking for Watts. He's one of the top guys in the promotion. He definitely wanted to stick it to the Von Erichs.
Well, and they had, you know, and they had the other key act. You know, Watts had the other key act, which was the Freebirds. You know, the Freebirds was, you know, you would think I can go to Dallas with the Freebirds. That's not the dumbest idea in the world.
And Chris Adams.
Yeah, Chris Adams.
Yeah. Oh, well, not for long.
He
was
speaking of nice guy baby faces on television and maybe a little different off the air. Chris Adams.
Yeah. Now Buddy Landell makes his surprising return here on the October 12th tapings in Tulsa, which aired on October 18th, as he went over Jeff Rates. And also on that TV show, we got Devastation Incorporated turning on Savannah Jack. Skandar Abrar hit Jack by mistake, and after the match, he yelled at him. What's the Baron Von Raschke angle? Before back jumping him along with bad Leroy Brown. Jack, though, made a comeback after One Man Gang missed his big splash, and he delivered super kicks to all the heels as the fans went ape shit. The main event of this show was the country whipping match between Ted DiBiase and Terry Taylor going over Michael PSA's and Buddy Jack Roberts, with Taylor pinning Roberts as revenge for Buddy beating him for the TV title the previous month. The post-match angle, though, saw Ted KO Roberts using the black glove, but Hayes was still the glove, and he KO'd DiBiase. Yeah, this Savannah Jack's one of those guys who Watts got hot, and he had a cool look.
Well, you know, there's a difference between everybody cheered for him at the television taping and making him and him being successful.
Exactly.
He
got him hot on television, but it fizzled out. But that country whipping match was an awesome match, you know.
We've
been watching that over the years, and yeah, DiBiase at this time period. This is my favorite era, Ted DiBiase, because he was heel for so long. He turned babyface, but he still was Ted DiBiase, and he would break out that black glove when he needed it. So he was a tough guy, babyface. The fans were just nuts for him. The Freebirds were perfect foils because of the whole history in Atlanta. I mean, this was great stuff, Bruce, but the Japanese commitments, like you said, just damaged the continuity so much.
Yeah, I mean, those matches were really fun. And Savannah Jack is, I don't know how many replacements, African-American heroes that Bill Watts tried to use to replace the Junkyard Dog, including going to WCW with Ron Simmons, and failed with. And Savannah Jack is one of, you know, a long line. They just could never get the guy quite there with the support and the it factor. And just the Dog was such a phenomenon. It just made it tough to follow up on it. I do want to say something about Baron Von Raschke. Baron Von Raschke was getting old, and he was about to – his time was getting due too. And so you could throw him in there with Valiant and have him be a character babyface. But they were – you know, Crockett was running him out too. Crockett was getting rid of some of the older talent at that point.
Now, Buddy Landell, of course, like I said, made his return here. Buddy Landell at this time period, 1986, was not the same Buddy Landell the year earlier in Crockett promotion. Or even 6 months earlier. It was – wow. Talk about a guy who was so troubled. You know, we did a Buddy Landell show, you know, talk about his troubled career, but so young, so full of potential, and just his vices just took it down the drain.
I always thought that what made Buddy Landell such a charismatic guy was also what drove him to ruin his own career. I mean, he was just so full of it in an entertaining way that it just overtook him. And you know, you're right, the drug addictions and all that. But he was well on his way to earning his nickname in the business, which was No Show Budrow.
Yeah. Now this is a funny note. We talked about the UWF World Class War. It's raging red hot and heavy in the Metroplex area, Dallas-Fort Worth. After the World Class show that aired on October 18th on KTVT, there was a voiceover in the credits of this World Class show by Chris Adams pimping the new Power Pro Wrestling show that would be airing on KTVT, which made quite a few WCCW people upset. I can only imagine Fritz, you know, cutting a promo on the KTVT guys, but yeah, World Class was, and we're about to talk about them in a second. They were really going downhill this time period, and the Dallas market in general, which, you know, it kind of you kind of understand why Watts made his mindset of maybe going there thinking he could resurrect it, but also you should got to think about the fact that hey, if this is a dying place, I don't need to come here.
Well, the Von Erichs did a lot of damage to wrestling fans' faith in their heroes, just a lot, and that's, you know, that's definitely a factor that maybe, you know, no one ever revived Dallas after that. No one ever got it up and running, and until, you know, the national promotions were just the national promotions.
Exactly. And Bix, talk about KTVT and how powerful it was.
Yeah, so I've been trying to figure out for the last couple of years, like occasionally I'll try to like look into it, like what exactly the actual reach was, because you'll occasionally hear things like Gary Hart's book makes it sound like they had a reach throughout the whole Southwest going back into the late 60s. And I'm not sure if it's that. I think that might be a little exaggerated, but pretty much as soon as there was cable, and I think in the Southwest there were part places where it arrived early because of the way things were so spread out in places. Like if you had cable within the Southwest, once there was cable, you had KTVT. I mean, so different parts of Texas, into Oklahoma, into, I guess, even parts of New Mexico or places like that. But primarily, you know, like a Texas, Oklahoma, you know, part, you know, border part of Arkansas, that they, I mean, it was huge. I mean, that was, a lot of people don't realize when they look into the history, they almost think of that being kind of like a B show, but that really was the primary show for that office in the Dallas-Fort Worth market. And it was just separate from the World Class stuff. And that stuff's fun to watch. I mean, maybe not as much the matches. The matches are, like, for whatever reason, just the matches on that show weren't always that good, except maybe like some of the main event type stuff. But those are the best promos you'll see on any of the stuff from that promotion, because that's when you get just, you know, Cornette, Gino, Adams, all the good heel promos, just kind of doing regular, you know, one after the other, promoting, you know, the next house show type local promos. And we don't really have that otherwise from that promotion. So that, I mean, that stuff's a lot of fun to watch. But I mean, and overall, though,
yeah, Gino Hernandez was a riot. Yeah. Gino Hernandez, your champion. I mean, you know, I've had friends, and I've used that myself for like forever. You know, it's like that's, you know, we are your champions. It's like, it sounds like such a simple line, but he was so great at it.
Was he the first one that used that line?
I couldn't tell you, but I think he's, you know, but yeah, he was the most famous one. He just do the belt. He would just do his hands over the belt and, you know, I am your champion, you know, it's like, and just say it in a way that would just irritate the crap out of people. But he was, and he was completely believable as a, you know, as a rich jerk. I mean, he was, you know, living the life because he was a rich jerk living the life.
Now, have you checked out NWAClassics.com yet, Bruce?
You know, believe it or not, I'm on New Japan, but no, I have not. And I'm kind of just waiting for them to just build up a lot of it. To tell you the truth, I have a lot of old stuff, so I'm just kind of waiting for it to like wait for the library to get a little bigger, and then I'll be on it. But yeah, it's a matter of time.
I ask because Gino has been so far, like, because they have already put up a lot of stuff that wasn't already available, like stuff that didn't air on TV and stuff.
Oh, I know.
Gino is like the find of that, because like I was already a Gino fan. I mean, Chris, I know, was already a Gino fan, but like we're seeing so much more stuff, like the Jose Lothario feud and him working with Wahoo. It's just, he's a guy
Harley.
That doesn't get, yeah, Harley Race now. He's just a guy that just doesn't get enough credit. And like, you know, and now, and since this stuff has come out too, I mean, you'll hear like, you know, Dave Meltzer always talking about now on Observer Radio, like, he always tells young wrestlers, like, if you want to find someone to, like, study for promos, for heel promos, you should watch Gino.
Yeah, I agree with that. Gino was great. Gino was just – he was a little bit limited in the ring, but as far as, like, a persona and an ability to talk and just get your attention and piss you off, he had it, you know, right from the beginning. And, you know, well-trained and 17 years old or whatever it was when he started. But, yeah, that's some stuff that when I hear him and Jose Lothario, my understanding was that was hot stuff and need to see that. And, him, and anything with Wahoo, that's good.
Yeah. Now, moving on to World Class, as we were talking about, George Scott is now booking for World Class, and he had a deal set up with the WWF to have Ricky the Dragon Steamboat work the annual Cotton Bowl show on October 12th. And Dave Meltzer reported that he fully expected that Bruiser Brody and the Von Erichs will be making shots for the WWF in the immediate future, although not really on television, but in a position to work shows against possible UWF shows in WWF markets, as well as Madison Square Garden. Now, of course, this never happened. But Bruiser Brody and the Von Erichs in the WWF ring in 1986, that would have been like culture shock.
You know, I read that and go, that's the deal. But I would have thought Brody would have wanted to like not make any kind of appearances until he brokered himself into WWF to face Hulk Hogan and take the leg drop. When that day came, at a bit, because he would have been a great monster to chase Hulk Hogan. The thing that's so weird about that, it was so weird. You know, George Scott was one of those bookers that he was. You know, he was the Crockett booker when they went from tag team, you know, mediocre territory to arguably the most talented, best drawing territory in the world. And he was the architect of a lot of that. And a lot of that was he delegated programs to the right talent. And he was also, you know, the booker for the first WrestleMania until he ran afoul of Hulk Hogan. And he was the guy who booked Ricky Steamboat to be Ricky Steamboat. So Steamboat had a loyalty to him. But Ricky Steamboat in the Cotton Bowl booked against, of all people, that no talent Ron Poe.
Oh, God,
it's like,
yeah.
Why in the world are you doing that? And you could see this falling apart from the beginning. Nobody really, you know, WWF was competing. They weren't looking to make those moves. And World Class was desperate. And, you know, and Fritz Von Erich wanted his thing to make some money, and he had other interests. And so he was, you know, he wasn't going to let George Scott address anything that needed to be addressed. And the first thing that needed, you know, like Gary Hart, you know, you've read that book. It's a very well done book. And yes, you know, and nobody could address the problem with the Von Erichs and the brothers having, you know, being, you know, having such an addiction and all the scandals around it and all the denial around that just really was deadly to that promotion. But yeah, it was you'd watch it and go, this is pretty good. When Brody was there, you look for Brody. Kerry Von Erich was there, and then Gino and Chris Adams were a lot of fun. You know, they were really good, but it was, you could tell things were headed downhill, and then, you know, headed downhill in an awful way, as it turned out.
Right. I mean, around this time it's really beginning of the end, because Adams is gone, Gino died earlier in the year. Carrie's her.
Oh, okay. That already happened. Okay.
Right. So you've got, I mean, it's really, you know, Kevin is really, this is the beginning of the end for Kevin being a full time wrestler. So it's really, I mean,
Kevin
Lance is the top face at this point, right?
Yeah. Kevin was a guy, went from being a guy worth seeing to one of the worst wrestlers in the business, and pretty quickly.
Yeah. Your headliners at this time were Brody, Abdullah, Black Bart. Brian Adias and Al Madrill turning heel, stuff like that. That was what was going on World Class this time period.
Was Dingo so, around yet? Was
Dingo Warrior was around?
Was he a headliner yet?
Not. He was on his way.
He was. He was there. He was a headliner. I mean, he was never really a headliner. And they were trying, you know, they were trying guys like that that weren't very good. Was it Brody took over after George Scott? But the George Scott thing was just, it was, you could have, and I'm a big Brody guy and I understand Abdullah, but it's, but the one, once you've seen Brody and Abdullah have their walk and brawl, you've pretty much seen it. And neither one, it's like the, the famous story of somebody's got to lose this match. I don't know who's going to lose, because they would, because they wouldn't lose to each other. So they wouldn't lose a match. And so just like, if you kept, that line George Scott, the line Gary Hart has in his book about there's only so many times you can watch Abdullah slice up those white boys is really true. I mean, it's like he was much better and bring him in, horrify everybody, and get him out before he loses that monster appeal.
Exactly. Now, even though World Class bought out USA All-Star, which was the former Southwest Championship Wrestling, it doesn't look like they assumed all their old debts other than paying off the TV stations so they could get the time slots so they could air the new tapings from Gillies. That first taping took place on October 17th and drew a few hundred people. Now, David, they did not tape at Gillies for a long period of time, but it gave an interesting look to the product. And, they tried in San Antonio, and it just didn't work out. But, at least they were trying something different.
Yeah, I mean, I've only seen a very small amount of this. I mean, they weren't using it for the main show even. It was just for what was it? I guess Tempo, right? And also whatever Fred Barron's, regular syndicated stations they had left. And I mean, like, from what I've seen, it's a very weird show because it's like they don't really do – if they do interviews, it's not storyline related. It's just kind of like in a vacuum as a separate show. And I don't really get what the point was, except I guess – well, the Gilly shows I think were sold shows, so that's probably why. But otherwise, yeah. it's just weird stuff. But I mean, the Gilly shows are kind of interesting. I mean, they did – I think All-Star did a better job of kind of shooting Gillies to make it look interesting and kind of get the most out of the venue. Because it was kind of a cool-looking place if you kind of – knew how to shoot it and get kind of the club atmosphere like later. Why am I forgetting the Amazon? Wild West did a little bit with Billy
Wild
Bob's.
West.
Yeah.
When I started seeing that stuff pretty soon after that, I just thought, I liked it in that it was wrestling, but it was clearly wasn't going to last.
Yeah. Now, Steve DeSalvo, you talk about guys that had concrete in shoes and wrestling ring. Steve DeSalvo is expected to come here instead of the WWF when he returns from Japan in November. That's what Dave Meltzer reported, but that never happened. So it was actually a good thing for World Class, but I don't know if you ever saw much of DeSalvo, Bruce, but oh my God, what a horrible wrestler.
Strangler Steve DeSalvo, yeah. There was, we wax poetic about the old days, but there was plenty of things in the old days that weren't that great.
The best thing he ever did was he played a devil worshiper in Puerto Rico, Steve Strong, and he would do promos hailing Satan. So that's probably the best thing DeSalvo ever did. But God,
I tell you what, that's high praise right there.
I've seen a lot of Calgary, and I've seen like most of his Calgary run. I actually liked his stuff in Calgary. Like I'm trying to think, when did he really just kind of disappear? Like 88, 89?
Or 90 like was when his 90 he was still, I mean, he worked WCW tapings in 1990.
That's right, his Minotaur.
His Minotaur, yeah.
But he became a pretty good, well, I mean, maybe it's just in terms of watching Calgary tapes and thinking someone's a good promo, maybe it gets kind of skewed watching Calgary. But I kind of liked some of his stuff there. He became a pretty solid heel promo. I mean, also, when you think of by the standards of green guys who would come through there, I mean, Bill Kazmaier or whatever, he made a better counting of himself. I mean, he wasn't great or anything, but I think if he went the right places, had the right people to work with, had the right seasoning, I think he could have improved more. I don't think it was ridiculous for promoters to see something in him, but he was not, he needed a lot of work though. Absolutely.
Well, in that time period, the big steroided up guys were, the promoters were drooling over guys like that. So that's why those guys kept getting, second chance. While some of your more talented guys that weren't as big, got the shaft. in a lot of ways, but that was wrestling in the 80s. But anyway, Bruce, you got to dip out on us. Real quick, get your plugs in again.
Yeah, just worth mentioning, there's a whole collection of my articles over the last 25 years because you guys invited me on in October, which is my 25th anniversary as
awesome.
The Torch columnist. So hopefully people check all those out at pwtorch.com. But even more exciting than that, well, maybe not even more exciting than that, but pretty exciting is the new revamp of pwtorch.com and pwtorch.com/goVIP. If you're a VIP member, go to that. I mean, it's a lot easier to navigate. There's a ton of stuff to look at, to listen to read. Not quite back to 1986, but almost. And really proud of the job Wade did and his web design staff did on this. This is really cool. Enjoyed being with you guys. This is a good deal.
Yeah, I mean, we'll definitely have you back in the future if that chance happens. No doubt, man. It's an honor to have you on this show.
Well, be that as it may. But, yeah, we can do it again. I should say, too, Travis Bryant and I, pwtorchlivecast.com, we host a free podcast every Friday night at 7 to 8 o'clock, or you can download it on pwtorchlivecast.com, going over the week's events. And then there's – then all the things over the paywall with Bruce Mitchell audio show over 2 hours, including talk with Mark Madden that I just finished right before I talked to you guys. So hopefully people will check that out.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, me and Bix will be back in just a few minutes to go to the Land of the Rising Sun and talk about the happenings over there. But we're also going to take our commercial break right now too. So let the place to be boys pay their bills and when we come back, like I said, we'll go to All Japan Pro Wrestling. See you in a few.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Lounge hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, we're back, and listen to all those great Place to Be Nation podcasts, especially mine and David's. And
I don't have any other ones.
Well, your guests, you guest on shows.
Well, sure. Actually, yeah, so, I don't think I ever plugged the Dig in the Crates last week.
Well, you can do that. Hey, we got plugs.
No, I plugged it on the show. I don't know. I think I plugged it anywhere else.
Well, yeah, ain't the first time you forgot to plug stuff other places. Let's put it that way. But anyway, we're going to the Land of the Rising Sun in All Japan, and a story that ties into the Magnum TA story. As NWA World Heavyweight Champion Ric Flair was supposed to tour All Japan from October 18th through the 22nd, but he never went, mainly because he was shook up about what happened to Magnum. And he stayed around, you know, to see how he was doing, hanging around the hospital. This, though, was the beginning of some major issues that Giant Baba would have with JCP for the next couple of years, i.e. getting bookings for the champion, stuff like that. Bix, you know, NWA champion in All Japan was, you know, hand in hand for many years. Baba was one of the top promoters in the organization. Once he stopped getting bookings on the champion, that was a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Now I'm trying. Well, because also, I mean, I guess he was still getting AWA champion bookings too, but that's not as big a deal at this point. And,
no.
I mean, they it's not like they needed it at this point really anyway, because they were going in a different direction. This is around the time, and it's, I mean, really 87, where you start to see like the world champion coming in, and it seems like it doesn't fit.
Well, I think this is also the, you know, not getting the champion led to the creation of the Triple Crown.
Yes. Although, what was I going to say? Just now I'm forgetting what I was saying. So as far as Baba, I guess, being upset about it, that seems like kind of a Japanese cultural thing, because I'm thinking back to, like, you know, when Art Barr died and Eddie Guerrero being on the New Japan tour, and New Japan refusing to letting him leave the tour early, go to the funeral or anything or whatever it was. I mean, it reminded me of that, and I don't know. I mean, it's just, I don't know. What do you think of that?
I understand the cultural deal is, but again, the NWA world title was a huge deal. Yes. In Japan for many years, and not having the champion come through, and when Flair was champion, he never did go over a lot. It was not Harley Race. No. You know, Harley Race was there all the time when he was champion. Flair never liked working for All Japan, so that's one of the main deals there. So,
I mean, once he got paranoid, thinking Jumbo was going to shoot on him and begged Harley to go to ringside with him.
Yeah, exactly. So again, this is a start of a paradigm shift in how All Japan views outside promotions, especially American promotions, which would definitely get worse as the years went on.
That's certainly one way to put it.
Yeah. Now, speaking of international, the International Federation of Associated Wrestling Styles announced on October 18th that they were going to disallow Yoshiaki Yatsu from being able to compete on the 1988 Japanese Olympic wrestling team. The decision was made basically because Yatsu is a professional wrestler. This was a big deal because Yatsu was getting in shape to do this. He was preparing and all that, and this basically killed his dream.
Yeah, and when Dave says basically because it's a professional wrestler, well, I guess I don't know if you took verbatim you took this because I'm looking at our notes. it's really twofold, because it's like they disqualified him because he was a professional athlete, but it's probably more the whole amateur wrestling hating professional wrestling thing, I would think.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, that's not around as much as it used to be, but it's still kind of a thing, and this is just, it's so stupid that they, I mean, look, if you're going to say, you know, if you're going to talk about how much you hate fake pro wrestling, then how is he a professional athlete? You know what I mean? So.
Exactly. And it's also led to the, you know, the deal after Choshu left when Yatsu and Jumbo hooked up as the Olympians.
Although, now, Yatsu had already been on the Olympic team years earlier.
Yeah, that's true, in 80, but still, this was what was fresh in the mind.
Right. Now, I'm trying to remember, though. Did he successfully sue and make the team?
Because
he did sue them, right?
Yeah.
He just sued Fila.
He sued Fila. I don't think he didn't make the team because he didn't go to the Olympics. I don't remember him going.
Did he make the trials?
I think he did go back to the trials.
But he was deemed eligible. He won whatever lawsuit he had.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically his name was cleared, I guess you could say. So, but yeah, that was a... Like I said, Yatsu at this time, you know, Ishin Gundam is, you know, still a big deal, although that's about to change, as I'm about to talk about. But, yeah, for him to, you know, devote time to doing that, I mean, that showed what his passion was. So, but anyway, like I was saying, there are rumblings going around that Riki Choshu is extremely upset with how much the debut of Hiroshi Wajima is being pushed by the promotion, and he thinks it's getting out of hand. Choshu feels like his guys are being put on the back burner. Those rumors flamed even further on October 15th when Osamu Kawanobe reported in Tokyo Sport that the WWF is interested in signing Choshu, as he met with one of the WWF officials, Jim Troy, at Titan Towers while he was in the United States. And Troy told him that the WWF wants to tour Japan in 1987, but they're having problems getting on TV there. So they feel like acquiring someone like Choshu would be able to get them where they needed to be. Troy told Kawanobe that the WWF planned on running shows between All Japan and New Japan tours with four tours a year, so they wouldn't be running competition directly against anyone. Now, you know, WWF was talking about running Japan for from 1985 until 1990, and really going to 91 before they eventually hooked up with SWS.
And then that was the whole thing in 94.
Yeah, Vince always had his eyes on Japan. You know, I mean, it was just every year you would hear something about that. Now, imagine signing Riki Choshu, Bix. I mean, how does that change Japanese wrestling because he doesn't go back to New Japan? I mean, it changes it a lot.
I think he quits and goes back to New Japan. I mean, I don't see any way in which that goes well. Do you?
No.
Every way, wrestling style. I mean, what type of gimmick do they give him? I mean, do they just pay him to have a dojo and run small shows? I mean, what, you know what I mean? Between tours? I mean, I don't get what, I mean, I get what they're thinking, but I don't see what they, what do you think they thought they had for him between tours?
I guess come over and be a guy managed by Slick. Slick or Mr. Fuji or something like that. Probably a stereotypical role. Probably he would probably got matches against Hogan.
No, I know. He replaces Randy Colley a smash.
Oh my God. Can you imagine him in the face paint? And then he had to shave his head. Because, you know, Demolition, and, you know, early
well,
on.
Right. Smash had the shave. Well, that was only because what that was only because Tadarso had the shaved head, though.
Well, yeah, that is true, but. And the other story here is Hiroshi Wajima. Yeah. You know, God.
People were upset that he was getting pushed so much, but not necessarily for the same reasons as Choshu. Although some of it probably for the same reasons as Choshu.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty ridiculous. You know, we watched all the television for that, for the 80s set. And oh my Lord. I mean, I hadn't seen anything like that from Japan, pushing a guy like that like they did coming in.
That match,
and boy, did he bomb.
The match he had with Tom McGee is just magical.
Well, for many different ways.
Yes. Because, well, I mean, here's it should have been clear from the beginning that it was never going to work. Because it's like someone like I'm forgetting his real name all of a sudden. New Arashi. Sao Takagi, right?
Yeah.
He never got great. Although he got very good as Arashi, but he was like he had potential, even if he wasn't that good at first. And yeah, some of the other sumo guys. John Tenta was very promising at first. Wajima was just too old, too slow. I don't get what they saw him. And it was the end of the Matsuma Hall. Because the Sumo Federation was like, no, that's it. You're signing too many sumo guys, too many of our sumo guys away.
And that, yeah.
I mean, because, you know, who had All Japan had brought in, because there was Takagi, Tenryu, Wajima. I feel like I'm forgetting one or two guys. Taue.
Yes.
Tenta.
Yep. Yes.
They signed a lot. They signed a lot more sumo guys than New Japan did.
And there were other guys that were, like, signing up or being rumored to sign that actually never went.
That they were recruiting.
That they were recruiting. So, yeah, they were going hard for it.
Yeah, and I wonder why New Japan never really did that. Maybe because they knew we don't want to piss off Sumo Hall, I guess.
Well, there's a tie-in with Bob and Sumo and stuff like that. They went for more to Sumo guys than New Japan did.
Well, why did they gravitate more?
I guess I guess because Baba was a big guy himself.
Even though maybe that has something to do with it.
He wasn't a sumo, but he was a big guy.
So he's going to flock to the sport in Japan that's going to give you the most big guys.
And Inoki was not a small guy, but he was more an athletic guy.
Right. He's a track star. So he's going to be more into guys who are really like explosive, impressive athletes.
Yeah. Exactly. And we were talking about New Japan. Keiji Muto made his grand return to New Japan after a long excursion to the United States on October 13th at Korakuen Hall, where he would lose to Tatsumi Fujinami, his mentor, in the semifinal in 1747. Meanwhile, Antonio Inoki battled Dr. Death Steve Williams to a double countout in 6:46. Muto was said to look sensational in his return, and that was definitely true. But in Japan, he was still considered a junior heavyweight, quote-unquote, and the buzz was more around the debut of Wajima on November 1st for All Japan.
So go ahead.
That Muto Fujinami match is really good. Really good. I mean, Muto, when he came back, was that?
I'm trying to remember if I've seen that one or not.
Oh, it's so good. Muto, when he came back
I have just not in a while, but go ahead.
Yeah, when he came back in this time period, it was so fresh. I mean, it was a definite spark to their scene. And it was just like watching, you know, the junior Fujinami in there and the stuff he had against Takada and when they were in the UWF matches. I mean, it was so great to see him back. And of course, he would leave again, you know, later on and go back to the United States. But talk about this era of Muto, the space lone wolf version of Keiji Muto.
I think this might actually be, at least in New Japan, I think this might actually be my favorite era of Muto. He was really good. Now, I didn't know he was considered a junior heavyweight, though. I mean,
well, that's what his perception was by the fans. I think some of the smart fans.
Junior heavyweight sized.
No.
He was a big guy.
But he worked that style. He worked that style, though.
Yes.
For a heavyweight.
Right.
And again, you know, Wajima is the sumo and all this other stuff and getting that praise. Because Japan, this time period, you got to remember, Japan is still size. They're like size fetishes.
And there was always an issue. I mean, we go back to when Noah tried to push Kenta and Mara Fuji as the top guys. I mean, that's not that long ago either. And that was kind of the because I mean, Misawa was still around, but that was kind of the beginning of the end. But as far as before Misawa died, but I mean, as far as Muto, I mean, he's just so good. I mean, like you said, all the stuff with Takada. I mean. I don't think they really had any singles because Takada was kind of a junior heavyweight on his own, but the tag, you know, their roles in the 5-on-5 matches with the New Japan versus UWF, then all the tag team stuff with Muto and Koshinaka against Takada and Maeda, which is an amazing tag team feud. All that stuff. I mean, even just other stuff like the El Connect match is kind of fun.
Go ahead.
Just this whole, like, it's just everything he's in is fun, but really, especially just all those tag, all that IWGP tag title stuff around this time that he's in that mix is amazing, and stuff that doesn't really get talked about much. Like the junior stuff with Takada and Koshinaka gets talked about, but not really the tag stuff they did with Muto and Maeda. Like Maeda really, you hear about him in the context of the New Japan UWF feud as a whole. But really, I feel like people kind of skip over this era for him when he's really – I feel like this is some of his best work, and it's because of he's working with Muto and all those guys.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Death, this was like his first big tour of New Japan. I mean, I think he had toured once before, but this was like his main event tour. And as you know, we were talking about with Bruce, you know, one of the UWF guys that was being injured because they shot a big injury angle with him where – I think this is the one where they pile drove him on the floor. You know, the rip off the
broken, this is the broken arm, I think.
The broken arm. That's right. The pile drive on the floor was the first tour. So they were doing all these injury angles to get these guys out of there. But Dr. Death, I mean, he got over strong when he came to Japan. Of course, he had other issues in Japan, which we talked about on the UWF shows. But he's the type of guy that definitely, we talk about size guys, he was perfect for that scene.
Are you talking about how his luggage has drawn more money than Sting?
Yes! His luggage is a better Hall of Fame candidate than Sting is.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think how much of this I've seen, because I know I've seen like the stuff like the stuff that was on those World Pro Wrestling from Japan tapes from a little later on. I mean, he was always a good fit, though, for
Dusty
Japan.
Dusty Woods tapes?
Yes. Wait, do you know the backstory on Dusty Woods Entertainment?
I know of it, but go ahead and tell everybody else.
So I didn't learn about – I think I like it was in the Observer. Was it in the Observer or was it – because I remember there was like this – was it late ECW that they said that this was going to tie into – that it was the guy who did Adult Video News, which was sort of like – I guess started as like the Observer for porn and then became like a big magazine and stuff. He was a big wrestling fan, and he used his connections in, you know, video distribution, whatever, to do those tapes, which had a
– Steve Hirsch, right?
Of –
Vivid.
No. I think it's a different guy. But because
I know Steve Hirsch is a big wrestler.
Right.
Man.
He's another one of those names you would see in the Observer and stuff too. But it was another Jewish name. I'm trying to remember.
Al Rosenberg.
Isn't that the Screw magazine?
Yeah. Well.
No. But it was. But anyway, he put all this stuff.
Seymour Butts. He's a Jewish guy born.
that's good to know. So where was I? So he put these tapes out, which had a Stately Wayne Manor on commentary and all that. But anyway, those were. So if you ever seen it was World Pro Wrestling for Japan Volume 1 and 2, Bam Bam Bigelow and Friends, and what was the Birdie one called? Was it Bruiser Brody Forever?
Yeah, something like that.
And I think it was originally going to be called Bloody Bruiser Brody, but then it came out right after he died. So like, hey,
maybe
we shouldn't have the video with the guy, featuring the guy who's been stabbed called stabbed to death called Bloody Bruiser Brody. So yeah, it was Bruiser Brody Forever. So anyway, Doc's one of the guys who featured prominently on those. But because I'm trying to think. So at this point, was Watts the only one that was booking Americans in Senior Japan, or was Fritz also doing?
Fritz, I mean, the Von Erichs were going over.
Okay,
but this was the time period where they were starting to have their problems because I think it was. Maybe the week or two before this was when Mike had that match with Kimura, King of Kimura. That was really bad. Because Mike was all kinds of messed up in the match. It was terrible.
Sending Mike to Japan at this point was not a good idea.
Yeah.
Because I mean, this is post-toxic shock.
And
if you're talking about sending someone who actually has brain damage to Japan, I mean, that's really not a good idea. And what was the other thing I was going to say? It is interesting, though. I never really thought about it before, because we're talking about the stuff with world-class and WF. You have warring promotions that both are sending their talent to New Japan.
Yeah, I know.
It's a little weird. And then, now I'm trying to think, was it Rick Hazard getting in trouble? Was that what? Was that the end of Fritz sending Ice to Japan, or
something like that?
The story I'm talking about, right? Where he peed like,
the cat. There was Kevin and the cat. That was also in this time period as well.
Yes, which I didn't.
But Rick Hatcher peed.
Dave told that story on the Sin Limite recently, but didn't he like pee on like a hotel plant or something?
Yeah, I thought he peed on somebody.
He peed on someone or something, and I believe the Yakuza were not happy. And
oh, I'm sure they weren't.
Didn't he end up with, like, the Vader, like, 1,000 cuts?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Oof.
Because that's one of the stories that's in Gary Hart's book, where he's like, it's someone from the office calling him barely, not really speaking English, and it's like calling him like Scott Hall, Rick Hazard, Kevin Von Erich, and he's just not sure what they're talking about. And the
you don't want to mess with the Yakuza, folks. And speaking of lands of serious gangs, we go to Mexico, where we have a couple of title changes during this week. That's El Halcón 78,
which is defeated. Well, wait, it's the same guy, right? Halcón 78 is El Halcón, right?
Pretty much. Defeated Luis Tigre.
What is that?
Well, pretty much the same guy, I guess. I don't know.
Same guy, right? It's the same person.
I guess.
Okay.
But he defeated Luis Tigre Mariscal for the Mexican National Light Heavyweight title on October 16th. And Kung Fu defeated Gran Cochise for the NWA Middleweight title at Arena Mexico on October 17th.
That match sounds awesome.
Yeah, now Cochise is a guy we watched in the 80s, Lucha set, that was one of the big revelations of how great he was as a mat worker. And Kung Fu, when he was on, was one of the one of the top guys as well. But how much Cochise have you seen?
Not a lot. I mean, I know he's good. I'm just trying to think which. I can't think of any specific matches. Cause, I mean, there's not a lot.
Well, he had the was it Americo Roca? I think it was Americo Roca that they had
a
great match with.
Is that from 84?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were like the maestros type mat work that you would see in the Nick Navarro matches back then. So definitely go out and look out for some Gran Cochise.
Who is Tigre Mariscal?
He's just a normal Rudo type of guy. He would, sort of nondescript, I guess you would say. He teamed up with Babyface and Scorpio. I think they were Los Tigres del Ring.
Oh, okay. I've heard of the trio.
Yeah, so, good Rudo. Good Rudo for the time period.
Of course, Halcón.
And speaking of guys that... what was that?
I just wanted to... with Halcón, I was thinking about... We need to nag Bruce Tharp to see if he can get some Halcón stuff up on NWA Classics, because at least by reputation, he was one of if not the best luchador at adjusting to working the American style.
Well, Bruce has put up Mil Máscaras and Grand Marcus lately, so I guess Halcón should be in the works if
didn't he tell Dave that he has some Santo stuff too?
Yeah, Santo worked in Houston in the 70s, so I would hope so. And talking about legends and the heels, talk about Mad Dog Vachon as we go to International in Montreal. And the 57-year-old Maurice Mad Dog Vachon wrestled the last match of his career on October 13th at the Paul Sauve Center in Montreal as he teamed up with Joe LeDuc to defeat Man Mountain Moore, who was Mike Moore. If you ever seen the AWA commercial videos that came out in the 80s, that's the guy that had a match with Sergeant Slaughter from the Showboat in Atlantic City. That was a really good match.
I just don't remember anything about
it. Considering Mike Moore was basically considered a job guy, but he really put on a strong performance in that match. And Gilles Poisson, who was one of the Yukon Lumberjacks with Scott Irwin in WWF and WWF in 1978. But anyway, Vachon had a storied career in pro wrestling, but he had launched a new career a month earlier as Inspector Gourmet, where he would visit the most exclusive dining establishments in Quebec City, where he would give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Vachon said that anyone could be a food critic, as they already are to begin with, but he doesn't take the job too seriously and is just being himself, having fun. But he never thought they would force him to wear a tuxedo every time. Vachon also will soon be starting a gig on CHOI-FM in Quebec City, where he would make appearances on their morning show, where he would be able to talk about any subject he felt like. Vachon said that he would miss the glamour and excitement of pro wrestling, but not the injuries such as 10 broken collarbones, 2 broken ankles, 2 broken arms, a bad neck, and numerous back injuries. Now, Bashan on that radio gig mainly talked about like politics and sports, which that had to have been fantastic. But Big Show, you know, I mean, we've seen stuff about Bashan. He was like a legend in Quebec, man. I mean, he did like rap videos. He did commercials. I mean, the guy was huge.
I really want to see Inspector Gourmet now. Even if it's in French, I still kind of want to see it.
Oh, cool, totally.
What a great promo.
I mean, just, awesome.
What an aura to it. Because he was a tiny guy. And
but you believe he could.
Oh, yeah. Even when he was older. Even when he was older.
Yes.
Against, you know, Jerry Blackweller. These caskets for you, Jerry Fatwell. That whole, yeah, you know, that whole thing. And
Bern Gagne.
And of course, you know, we were talking about Ivan Koloff earlier. Ivan Koloff's entire promo style is him doing Mad Dog Vachon with a bad
totally.
Accent. I mean, he admits it. You know, it's Mad Dog Vachon as Boris Badenov. And yeah, I mean, he's just big legend. Now, when was the accent? The accent was the year after, right?
1989, maybe?
After that? Okay. Well, oh, right, because he would have moved to Omaha by then.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, for people who haven't seen, I would see, if you really want to get Mad Dog Vachon, I would think the thing people should look up is look, if it's on YouTube, the promo where he's building the casket for Jerry Blackwell in the AWA. Would you agree?
Yes.
Like, if you see that and you don't get Mad Dog Vachon, then you just won't.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's a guy that I definitely wish we had more of from his prime period.
But, actually, I mean, you know what, though? I mean, we have a friend that put together a very nice DVD set that I think he got to Mad Dog, too. But that I keep meaning to get a copy of it for the last, like, however many years, and then I never do.
Yeah.
So I should try to check that out. Because I think he got a lot of, like, rare stuff for it, too. Didn't he? Like all sorts of, like, weird, like, films and other stuff and Japanese stuff. Didn't they, him and Butcher went to Japan a bit, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And they went, I mean, I'm trying to think, they headlined a lot of places. I mean, big territory, small, because I think not just Montreal, but they had AWA, Calgary, I guess.
Georgia.
Oh, Georgia, of course. Where else? Did they do WWF?
They may have done the Garden.
Well, I was going to say, did they do Garden pre-WWF? WWF?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I mean, Perez and Rock.
But Mad Dog went everywhere, though. He went Texas.
No, Mad Dog went everywhere, and the tag team, you know, was big other places, too. Yeah, he went to Texas on his – wait, so Butcher was not with him in Texas?
I don't think so. I know Mad Dog did a lot of single stuff in Texas. So, right. And speaking of AWA, where the Vachons, you know, became household names, I guess you could say, in America, Curt Hennig won the annual Battle Royal at the Civic Center in St. Paul, Minnesota on October 19th in front of a horrible crowd of 1,500 fans, down from 12,000 in 1985 and 17,500 in 1984. Now, it's unfair because those shows, I think, actually took place on Thanksgiving, and this one didn't. So we probably kind of need to have that, an asterisk, I guess you could say. But listen to the lineup on this piece of shit show. Ali Khan, who is Tom Lentz, Boomer H. Lynch from Continental, fought Steve-O to a draw. Then we had the Super Ninja, played by Shinji Takano, going over Earthquake Ferris. We had Curt Hennig going over Colonel De Beers by Count Out. We had Superfly, Jimmy Snuka, going over Boris Zukov. We had Crusher Blackwell and the Midnight Rockers. Whoa. Going over the Blaster, who was, I just found out doing the research for this show.
Oh, that's right.
Gary Lindgren, who I had seen results for, you know, in AWA shows going back in like 79, 80, and then just disappears
with newsletter writer Gary Langvin.
Yeah. Now, Gary Lindgren had Bell's palsy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he came back as the Blaster some 6 years later. But the Blaster, Buddy Rose, and Doug Summers. And in your main event, Larry Zbyszko, well, other than the Battle Royal, Larry Zbyszko over Nick Botwinkle with help from Super Ninja in less than a minute.
Oh, that's great. So you're drawing 1,500 people, and then you decide to kill the town with that.
Exactly. Now, Haney won a Battle Royal, assuring him of getting a shot at Nick Botwinkle's AWA World Heavyweight title on Thanksgiving night. Now, also as part of the Battle Royal, we had Silo Sam, who was Big John Harris.
He's still
from,
around in October 86.
Yeah, from other wrestling organizations such as World Class, Memphis, Continental. And we had Billy Robinson making a rare appearance at this stage of his career. Buck Zumoff was thought to be in this match, but he wasn't there, thank the Lord.
Well, who knows what he was, where he was and what he was doing.
I don't want to even think about it. But, wow, AWA in late 1986, definitely on the downward spiral. Although, that's some fun stuff going on, but down and down, down.
Yeah, they're past the point of no return at the fight now. I'm trying to think, when would you say would be like the... Where they just passed it?
Oh, man. Probably 87 was pretty fun.
Well, I mean, there was some fun stuff. I mean, in terms of like box office.
Oh, box office. This is the time period. Because early 86, they still were drawing some, but going like, I guess, summer 86 is when things started going down.
Although they still had some good places that were still drawing well, like Salt Lake and
yeah, like that. They had certain markets, and they drew pretty well in Chicago at times, but yeah, they were definitely having issues.
Yeah,
now, Scott Hall was advertised as working this show, but no show. Further speculation that he was WWF bound, which wasn't the case. Hall's absence was never acknowledged, but Johnny Rich's was that he had injured his knee at a show in Denver, Colorado 2 days earlier, was mentioned. Scott Hall. I was always rumored about him going WWF. And it never happened until 1992.
He never really developed into like a decent worker or anything, though. I mean, it's probably not a coincidence that once he finally kind of got that new, developed that new look for himself, that was when WWF wanted him. Because before that, he's still, you know, whatever you want to call him, Porn Stash Scott Hall, Magnum SH Scott Hall.
Magnum Scott Hall, Gator Scott Hall.
Starship, wait, was he Eagle or Coyote?
Coyote.
So he was American Starship Coyote. And then he kind of figures out he needs to make himself over, and that's when things started to kind of click into place. But I mean, it's not like he was never really that good worker before WWF. It's like he's a guy with a look and kind of. I mean, I guess he was okay in Memphis, but he had good opponents. Like, I don't know. I mean, I think it makes sense that they didn't really pick him up before then. I mean, they had enough big guys. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't ready. I mean, well, they took guys that weren't ready anyway, but. He could have went there, but I think he would have been ruined even more.
Now, for a guy with good opponents, though, I wonder why it took him so long to develop as a worker, though.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, he was definitely a late bloomer. I think maybe that Puerto Rico trip, you know, running there definitely helped him out. Because
what was that?
1990, 91.
Right before WCW,
yeah. Now, speaking of big guys around the AWA, John Dord, who quit the AWA a while back, is working as a car salesman in the Twin Cities, waiting on a phone call from any promotion that wants to use him. But his wife just had a baby boy, so he's probably going to stay at home as long as he can. Yeah, he left the AWA with no notice. Bruiser Brody was his mentor, so he basically pulled a Brody. And he eventually would go to work for World Class in early 1987, so he wasn't out of a job too long. But John Norm, you know, you watch him in Mid-South as the Barbarian with Jake Roberts in 1985. And you think, man, this guy, he's got the it factor. And, you know, he was aping, you know, his buddy Road Warrior Hawk in a lot of ways, but he had something. And then when he left Watts, he was never the same.
I wonder if that's the Brody influence, because, like, he went from working, like, having this, like, really athletic big man style and kind of, like you said, like, kind of with the mannerisms and stuff, kind of aping Hawk, to being this really poor man's Brody. And as we've talked about, like, we think Brody's kind of a rose-colored glasses guy for a lot of people. He never really clicked that much for me. I don't think for you that much either. And
I did enjoy him as Berserker. Ben just calls it a gimmick.
Yeah, us. I'm just trying to think, is there anything else that he really did? I mean, as a little kid, I got a little bit of a kick out of Yukon John Nord and Scott Flapjack Norton. That's about it. Although, I was going to say, though, as far as with the used car lot, I believe A Day in the Life of Nord the Barbarian, which is the weird short film about him working at the used car lot, is on YouTube.
Oh, wow. Yeah, definitely.
You've seen that, right?
I saw it on a tape years ago, but I definitely need to find that again. That's awesome.
It came up when I Googled for Day in the Life of Nord the Barbarian. If you look on YouTube, it is called Nord the Barbarian, a.k.a. the Berserker Lost Movie, and part one, and it's in two parts. And
oh, wow. Well, there's just some homework, folks, after this show.
It was
go watch that.
Yeah, it was like this, what would you call it, like an extended commercial for his dealership, kind of?
Yeah, sounds about right.
But it's like, I don't know what the point of doing an 18-minute thing was, but it's very entertaining.
Yeah. And speaking of entertaining, we go to Memphis, Tennessee, and there's not a whole lot going on this week other than the return of a longtime Southern wrestler named Dennis Hall. Now, he had been on television the week before sending a tape promo from his home, but he made his return to the studios after being gone for over 15 years with his valet, Dolly Parker.
Also his wife, right?
Also his wife, and he made his debut against Davey Haskins, who, even though it's Davey Rich, he beat him. And he's basically doing a country singer-type gimmick. Now, all didn't last but maybe a few weeks. But this was just so out of the blue. When we watched the 80s Memphis stuff, it just like, wow, where'd this come? I've never even heard of this run he had. And Dolly Parker, wow. I mean, what did you think about this whole deal here?
It's been a while since I watched it. Now, I'm trying to think, when they did that one-off Sputnik Monroe versus Billy Wicks match, was that 86 or was that later on?
That was at the same time period.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, so what program do we have going on at this point? And like,
you've got Lawler and Rich against Dirty Rose and Don Bass.
Okay, so right. This was coming out of the Fire and Flame stuff, and then Fire and Flame Unmasking and that whole thing.
Yeah.
They weren't drawing bad, but this was kind of one of the first times where the seams were starting to show in Memphis, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it seems like they were looking to bring back some past stars who had not been around in a long time, and that was what came out of it, because like I said, they also brought in Sputnik Monroe and Billy Wicks to do like this one-off match, first time in decades type thing against each other. And I'd have to look to see how it drew. Do you remember either of these?
They weren't, I mean, they had it, but it wasn't like the main event or anything.
It was a big deal, though. I mean,
it was a big deal, but it didn't really draw that great.
Yeah.
Memphis, and this time, I mean, this was like the lull between Lawler and Dundee and then going to Lawler Isle Rich.
Yeah, which started with kind of coming off the Kabuki when Kabuki came in, right? Kabuki,
yeah.
Was the program
and Snuka.
Wait, was Snuka in?
Snuka was around, yeah.
I forgot about that. And because this, I'm trying to think, so who's around?
I don't know if Snuka came in actually in 87.
Yeah, that's right.
He was teaming with JT Southern.
Yes. That was around, was that while Paulie and Idol were in, or was that after?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
I don't remember seeing any TV with him. Or was that, or was he only on the Memphis TV? Is that why? Because we mostly had the other stuff.
Yeah. We didn't have a whole lot of Memphis television up, like the Memphis shows proper.
That's what I'm saying. From 87, we really don't.
Yeah.
So it must have been, because a lot of guys in a lot of even programs didn't show up, like on the Evansville show and the Louisville show and all that. It's weird. Like, especially this era. This era seems to cut a lot more out for some reason.
Yeah, totally. 86,
87 than previous years in terms of what's cut out outside of Memphis.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff where if you're not seeing the Memphis show, that a lot is cut out. So what were we talking about? Oh, so Dennis Hall. Oh, so what was was it Memphis or was it a different promotion that had that ad, which I think was it a different Dennis Hall called Dennis Hall? Which territory was that?
When?
I don't think it was him, but it was like an 80s thing, and I know it's a thing I've seen a lot of territories. It was like a car towing company or a car auto body shop. It was something.
It wasn't him.
It wasn't him, but do you remember what I'm talking about? Like, have you ever seen it? It was just with the song that's like, just call Dennis Hall, that type of thing.
I can't remember which one it would be.
I think until I think for a long time, I think I thought it was the same guy, but okay. I was just making sure it's not the same guy, right?
No, I don't think it's the same guy.
Okay.
No. Moving on down south a little bit, going to championship wrestling for Florida. Lex Luger, for the first time in his career, did an angle where he was beaten bloody. And this time it was by Ron Bass and his henchmen at the October 15th TV tapings in the Spartan Sports Complex in Tampa, Florida, which aired on October 18th. Luger was stretchered out after Bass destroyed him with a steel chair. Now, this is, you know, kind of the getting towards the end of the run in Florida. Luger and Windham are your top faces. Ron Bass and Hacksaw Higgins are your top heels. Florida was interesting because I was reading the newsletter at this time period. All the heels were upset because they never got to win matches. Like on all the arena shows, they always jobbed. And they were upset about it. So that's an interesting way of doing business. It's having your babyface go over every single time. But Lex Luger.
Keep Windham happy while he's doing his penitence.
Yeah. And Lex Luger at this time period, this is, right before he's going to Crockett. I mean, the guy had a mega push by the Aftermags. He was the next big thing. Yeah, but people really don't know a lot about this run of Lex Luger. Talk about what you remember seeing Lex this time.
I remember first seeing it years later when Tivaldi would show this era of Luger. When they would show that video of him working out with Hiro Matsuda. You know the one I'm talking about, right?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I mean, he really wasn't good yet, but he had a presence. And honestly, I think like the persona and like the image he had at this point, I think it worked for him at least at the beginning better than it did later, like with the stubble and like the kind of like the darker clothing and everything. I think it added a little bit of toughness that he was missing until he could kind of figure things out in the ring to project it better. You know what I mean?
Yes. And at one point in this time period, he was working his matches wearing a tank top, wearing a white beater.
Right. And like
which was real weird.
And like the black workout pants, right? Like the black tights, right?
Yes.
But you know what I mean? Like he comes off like more of a badass in Florida.
Yes, and when he turned babyface, he really got over. But I think the fans really wanted to cheer him to begin with. Yeah. And he really got over the babyface, working with Windham. And then, of course, they get the Crockett, and they kind of play off that deal, and then Luger turns on Barry and joins the Horsemen. But, Florida stuff from late 1986 is definitely some interesting stuff to watch.
I've never seen that angle, so how did they play that off in the transitioning them into Crockett?
I haven't seen that. You're talking about the Crockett angle?
You're saying like that. So did they come in at the same time with the idea that they were partners in Florida? I don't think I've seen that.
No, Windham came in first, mm-hmm. and then Lex came in, and Barry was like would be on commentary talking about he was friends with Lex from Florida. And Dylan was recruiting from ringside, and Barry was like trying to keep him, say, hey, you don't want to be with these guys, stuff like that.
Oh, I've never seen that. Like, I for some reason, I thought that he always thought that he came in just straight away as the Horseman's associate.
No. He was like being recruited.
Oh, okay.
Now, Florida, like I said, Florida this time period is definitely not your 1982, 83 Florida. No doubt. It was a different time.
Who do they have working underneath? Because, like, you've got Ron Slinker and Tyree Pride working like right under the main events, don't you?
That would have been earlier in the year. Okay. This time period, you got the Fabs are working as the Fabs and the Sheepherders is probably the top feud mm-hmm. as a tag team. Then you got the Shock Troops with Ed Gantner and Mr. Kareem Muhammad around. Bad News, Allen is about to come in. God, who else is around? Sean Roy and Chris Champion are just now starting to get pushed.
Muto had been around and just left.
Muto had been around. Dewey 14 is there. Ron Simmons is starting out.
It's not a bad crew, but they've got a lot of
great guys. It's an eclectic group of talent. Yeah, it's an eclectic group of talent. So,
Fab Sheep Herder's feud was awesome.
Yes, it was. It was really, really good. Now, go to another place that has sunny beaches. We go to Hawaii.
Although it's an even deader territory than Florida.
Yeah, but they're trying to have a little interpromotional feud. Yeah,
I was surprised.
As Rocky Johnson and Neff Maivia ran their first show as competition against Rocky's mother-in-law / Neff's mother, Leah Maivia's Polynesian Pro Wrestling.
Neff was just friends who...
Well, I'm just going as what was reported by Dave Meltzer.
Neff, you know the story, right? That Neff and Peter met years later, and they became buddies and all that. But
they
got the name from Peter from Neff. That's where the British promoters got the name Maivia.
Yeah, but I'm saying that Neff was working as Peter's son. From what that was being reported, yeah, I guess so.
Is it possible like a Neff Jr. or something?
No.
This is the Neff who's still alive and like 90 years old?
Yes. I guess so. I don't know. I'm just going by what was reported. Okay. It's probably not. You're probably right.
There's something off here, but go ahead.
Yeah. And on October 16th in Waikiki, under the Hawaiian International Promotions banner, drawing 200 fans for the card. Now listen to this card. Battle Royal won by the Dancing Destroyer. Then you had the Black Panther fighting Samu to a draw. You had the Falcon, which is a guy from, I think the same guy from Florida, going over Palasi Brown, whoever the hell that was. The Midnight Rockers, that's right, Sean and Marty, going over the Blonde Bombers. Then you had Rocky Johnson going over Doug Summers, who was subbing for Buddy Rose. And your main event, Colonel DeBeers, battled Jimmy Snuka to a double countout. And yeah. In response to this, Leah Maivia forged a working relationship with Steve Rickard of New Zealand to co-promote shows together across the South Pacific. Okay. Yeah, Hawaii at this time period definitely was, dead. But this is, it wasn't too long after this that Lars Anderson, who was working with Leah Maivia, they had their falling out. But Hawaii at one point was a very strong place for wrestling.
Yeah, now the thing you're talking about with Lars was also the thing that led to the other guy who tried to promote who Leah threatened to have mobsters kill?
Yes.
Okay. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
I don't remember how that trial ended, so I'm saying allegedly. It's weird how many people you've got trying to promote what's more than a very dead territory.
Yeah, but it's Hawaii.
Although it's Hawaii, if you can get something going, you'll have access to good talent, yes. Because, whether it's between Japan tours or whatever, or even just, the lure of being in Hawaii. And, it used to be, it was Nick Bockwinkel who would say that, even if the pay wasn't great, and even at its peak, but, you'd live on Hawaii for 6 months and break even or whatever. But this is a weird show. I'm guessing half of these guys are former Boy Ipo under a mask.
Yeah, the other Leroy Brown.
Right. Is that the idea that if you can get something going, you have access to talent? Because this promotion had been pretty much. They were kind of dead as a full time office going back a couple years, and not exactly, but I'm trying to think.
'86 they still had some big shows. Flair was still going in '86,
right? But they weren't. They didn't really run a full. They didn't run a circuit anymore, though.
No, they were just running big Honolulu shows.
They still had weekly TV.
Yeah,
locally and also and on FNN in on cable, because they also weren't there. Weren't Kevin Sullivan and Fallen Angel hosting the TV for a while and stuff?
Yeah, and they were sending their promos in the Continental in Florida from Hawaii.
I love Kevin Sullivan probably booking four different promotions at once at that point.
Yeah, he was a renaissance man, no doubt.
And speaking
of promotion that Kevin Sullivan was part of,
question about this though. So what was I going to say though with the. I'm forgetting, damn it. Oh, Rocky Johnson. So I'm guessing this is right after he and Atta got divorced or were in the process of?
Yeah, yes. Yes. Yeah, that would be – he wouldn't be going against Leah if he was still in the family, no doubt.
Now, what was the end of him as a mainstream guy anyway?
Well, he went to – he was in Memphis in 87.
But other than that, I mean
– that was the end.
No, but I mean really post-WWF, though, he really doesn't do much.
He worked in Central States in Portland a lot.
When did he go back to Portland?
In 86.
Okay. No, but so what was he doing, like, in 84 after he left WWF?
He was in WWF. He went to Central States, I know, in late 85, somewhere around there. So he was around.
I feel like
he was in Hawaii. Though. He was in Hawaii doing Polynesian stuff.
So he kind of homesteaded in the
Him and Ricky.
Yeah.
His brother. And again, we talk about, you know, promotions that were – it's kind of a loosely aligned with Kevin Sullivan, Hawaii, ICW, the Savoldis. Dave Meltzer's reported that the promotion is asking for fans to buy stock in their promotion for $10,000, which prompted Dave to ask if they would find any suckers.
Oh, that's the Savoldis.
What a Ponzi scheme, huh?
So is this when Sullivan was booking, or is this – because they went through like a bunch of different looks in 86 –
He had booked in 86.
Because I know he had – right, and he brought a lot of Florida guys with him too. I mean, because there's ICW TV with Mulligan and Wyndham.
That was earlier in the year. Yeah.
Right. And I guess he would – was Buddy Rose in ICW via Florida?
Yes.
Yeah.
That would have been in the year before, 85.
I guess that was 85. But, yeah, I'm trying to figure out just around this time what it was because they – like because there was – like, towards the end of the year, they didn't really have any name guys anymore. Although I remember Virgil worked there as Soul Train Jones a little bit. They didn't really have anyone. And they also, there was also a little bit of time where Les Thatcher was the announcer and I think maybe the booker? Do you know what I'm about when it was Les and the Luthez doing commentary?
Yeah. And Austin Idol was there.
Austin Idol, Ox Baker.
Dory Jr., Carlos. That's when they were working with WWC at that time.
I think on and off they did maybe a little
bit. Yeah, I mean, they had a lot of interesting relationships they were working with.
They also had AWA relationship in 86, too.
Yeah.
Because they brought in – it's on YouTube. It's actually – have you seen whose YouTube channel some of that stuff's on? And I don't know how it's Mike Shields, the Memphis guy. Like, I don't know how – like, I guess he works with the Savoldis now or something? Because, like, he has stuff. Like, he has the Snuka stuff from – Svaldi and the Midnight Rockers and Bockwinkel and all these AWA guys working the ICW taping.
Yeah.
And Vern doing commentary.
Moving on to a complete different side of the spectrum, we go to the Los Angeles lucha scene, which was starting to thrive in this time period. And Tinieblas defeated Billy Anderson in a Mascara Contra Caballero match on October 18th at the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles. Billy decided to change his name to Skull Anderson afterwards, which was pretty cool since he's now bald. I never saw a crowd number, but Tenablis, you know, was still, you know, I guess a pretty big deal in this time period. Billy Anderson was a local guy, pretty good, but yeah, I don't know about this match would have win. What do you think?
Well, it's Tenablis. I
mean... yeah. And that's pretty much enough said.
When did Alushe come around?
I don't know exactly when.
Well, it was after, because there's that match that Bahari put on YouTube, when he was still a wrestler, before he was Alushe, right?
Yeah.
Because Gulliver was what's his name, right? Guafito, right?
Yes.
I don't remember, but so it would have been after like 1990, right?
Yeah.
So it was still several years away. Yeah, I mean the best thing about Tenablis was Alushe, and
he was not good.
Or as Bob Barnett likes to call him, Tiny Balls.
Yes. Now moving up the cut West Coast, going to the Pacific Northwest. Rip Oliver put up his Northwest Heavyweight title and his hair against Scott Doring's hair on October 18th at the Sports Arena in Portland.
Who's Scott
and at the he's just a Northwest guy. He worked that circuit for a while. And after referee Sandy Barr was bumped, Oliver used his arm, which was in a cast, and we're getting that a couple times in the show, on Doring to pin him. Doring was pissed off, but was reminded that this was a no DQ match, so he agreed to get his head shaved. At this point, though, the assassin, David Sierra, under the mask, jumped into the ring to congratulate Oliver, but attacked him instead, using his loaded mask to knock him out, and then told Doring to shave Oliver. Abuda Dean and Mike Miller ran out with chairs to chase them off, and no one got shaved. The story was that the assassin blamed Oliver for his mother losing her house. So, all right. What a way to just kill off your hair mask gimmick there, when no one getting their head shaved.
Which is the big gimmick, which is the big stipulation match in the territory going back years and years.
Yeah, and then you had this deal where assassins blame Oliver for his mother losing her house. I guess because he stiffed the most of money or something. I don't know, but wow. Portland this time period was definitely interesting because a lot of your names have gone, and now it's become the Rip Oliver show, pretty much. And I like Rip Oliver. Rip Oliver was a good hand. And there was some decent talent that was still there, but this was, again, this was not your Portland of 1982, 1983.
I mean, it's not even the Portland of 85. I mean, 85, they still had a lot of, you know, they had a much more loaded roster. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, you've lost Buddy Rose, you've lost Ed Wiskoski, you've lost Billy Jack Haynes. I feel like I'm forgetting other guys, too, but, I mean, those are all big parts, big stars in this territory. Oh, you've lost Matt Bourne. Yeah, I mean, there's...
You've lost Bobby Jaggers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... I mean, you're not even getting guys like... and you're not even getting, like Bob De La Sera type guys anymore. Like, you know, just kind of veterans who just kind of come in to, you know, do whatever, like, because it's the place where they can get work, you know what I mean? Because he was in his Carl Steiner year before getting your big push. I mean, he was never named, but, I mean, he's a, you know, solid veteran hand, and you're not even seeing that type of guy anymore. I mean, this was...
And you didn't have any Mexicans working as Indians, like, you know, in 1985, so yeah, it was just, yeah, they were starting to go down a little bit.
When does Buddy come back? 87 or 88?
Buddy comes back in like 88. Because that's around the time period that Billy Jack opens up his little group.
Yes. And I mean, they were really never the same after Buddy left for WWF. And all those guys.
No. Well, Buddy Rose was just phenomenal in the Pacific Northwest and a guy that doesn't get nearly enough love that he should get. No doubt.
Now, question. How were they drawing it? During these times,
well, they had pretty much, like, I think they pretty much quit running the bigger buildings in like Seattle and stuff.
But at least at the sports arena, then.
I never really saw numbers, so I wouldn't really know what to tell you.
But, well, actually, so wait, who was promoting Seattle and Tacoma and all that after Dutch Savage got forced out?
I have no idea.
Because I know, like, the rep with him was that his towns drew better. And he got, you know, that's where a lot of the pay came from, although, you know, Don Owen was honest, so he paid well for the smaller shows. But, yeah, so I'm kind of curious, like, when did it start to fall off as far as a place, you know, good pay, easy trips, etc.?
I really wouldn't know when to tell you. You know, we were talking about Montreal earlier and with Mad Dog Vachon. Now we go to the World Wrestling Federation, where the big news of the week is that Dino Bravo, who was basically in charge of Montreal at that time period, in charge of promotion, has made his return to WWF after an 8-year absence on the October 18th episode of Superstars of Wrestling. But this time, he's as a bleach blonde heel, managed by Johnny Valiant, beating jobber Tony Parks in 228. This was a huge move as Bravo, like I said, was in charge of promotion and left that position, bringing along Rip Martel, Tom Zink, and Frenchie Martin with him as part of a mass exodus. Yeah, I mean, Montreal was doing fairly good, you know, with those guys on top. But
they were doing very well still. I mean, the Rougeau's versus Garvin's was that year, right?
85.
Oh, that was 85. But still, I mean.
I mean, I think they may have did 86 too, but I know 85 definitely.
But, I mean, they were doing very well. They were probably, I mean, you could say, really, of the promotions that you don't think of as being the bigger promotions from that period, they were by far the best. And this is the end of that. Because I'm trying to think, when did the Rougeaus come in?
They were in like right before this.
So it's pretty. I mean, so it was Rougeaus, and I think Haku came in around the time they did.
Haku was before.
Okay, Haku was before, but still. So you've got really this big mass exodus over the course of a few months, and this is the end of it. And that was the end of Montreal as a really. They had another year or so.
Yeah, they had some pretty decent shows in '87.
Abdullah Butcher's babyface.
Yeah, but yeah, it was not, you know, what it was for sure.
No, and then,
but we got Rip Martel back in WWF, which he sorely needed at the time because he was so good.
Yeah,
but stuck in Montreal after AWA, which is amazing to me how he never got into, say, Crockett or Watts or anywhere. You know, got Rip Martel.
Maybe he was just making good money and wanted to be at home.
Yeah,
I mean. If you could, you know, because they were drawing well. They had a strong territory. It's a great wrestling city. It's a, you know,
yeah,
area. I mean, I can't really blame them. And then, you know, this leads to Pat Patterson always made sure to take care of Montreal.
Yeah.
As a city for WWF. And that, you know, always cultivate, you know, local stars. Like, I mean, I remember reading, you know, our friend Pat Lepard's book or with the, you know, about the history of Montreal wrestling. And they're talking about WWF kind of taking the city over. Like, you look at some of those main events they had, and it's very interesting stuff. Like, I remember one where it's like a tag match with Ron Garvin. Like, they're protecting him in Montreal, even when he's not really getting pushed elsewhere. I mean, it's then this is like, yeah, 89 or whatever. It's interesting stuff. And that really went through, I guess 95 is the end of it because of the whole blow up between Carl Ouellette and Kevin Nash, right?
Yeah. And then the Rougeaus wanted to work with WCW.
Well, that was before. Well, there was that split kind of started before that, and then that's kind of the end of it. I mean, it's really, I mean, they sort of tried to, they played a little lip service into it, like years later with, you know, having some Canadian guys there and doing stuff like when they gave La Resistance the titles in Montreal. But now, I mean, how often are they doing TV and major house shows and stuff there?
I don't know.
Because I know, obviously, they don't do TV in Toronto anymore, but...
No, you're talking about now?
Yeah, I'm thinking even now. Like, now, like, how much in the way of major shows are they giving Montreal?
They do house shows. And they've done TV,
right.
But it's like rare.
It's not like Toronto where they've completely abandoned them for TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of amazing. I mean, the bizarre world, blah, blah, blah. But I don't get it. Because it's they have these hot crowds, and it's not like the Montreal fans really turn on baby faces. You know what I mean? It's like they were not really that rebellious. It's not like Toronto. I think it's almost more the Montreal screw job thing that keeps them from running there.
Yeah,
as much for TV. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but they ran it so many times after the fact, though. I don't know. I think it's just Vince, you know, having one of his Vince moments.
Well, yeah, and. But I mean, it's still to this day such a strong wrestling city.
Yeah. Now, on the October 18th episode of Superstars of Wrestling, Jimmy Hart on the set of Piper's Pit in a segment that included Piper tying up Hart and pouring Listerine down his throat after Hart had given Piper some derogatory gifts, including a pink cowboy hat and a rope from Bob Orton Jr., so that Piper could go hang himself. Piper then forced Hart to sit down and close his eyes before he tied him up with a rope. And then Piper hopped off the set to show that his injured leg was now healed. Folks, that Roddy Piper babyface turn was insane hot. Fans wanted that so bad. And yeah, all these angles that, you know, was set up were just great stuff.
I believe all this stuff's on YouTube, the whole flower shop thing, Piper's Pit thing, right?
Yes.
Most of it is, I think.
Yeah.
Just the perfect way to bring Piper back. Now, I'm trying to remember, when did he leave, like, right after WrestleMania?
Yes.
Okay. So that's when it's...
Pretty much.
That's when it was clear that it was time to turn him, and then they bring him back after he's back from shooting. Was he shooting They Live, or what was he shooting then?
He was shooting They Live.
Yeah.
I think. Body, yeah. It may have been Body Slam.
Because I think
Dave Live was at the WrestleMania.
Shot after the after the WrestleMania 3 retirement, right?
Yeah, and so it'd been Body Slam.
Yeah. I wonder what Vince thought of. I mean, I know it was mostly his. Well, not exactly. I mean, so you have this movie where it's Roddy, two WWF wrestlers, Roddy Piper and Tonga Kid, who was.
Tonga Kid went in WWF at the time.
Well, he was in WWF by the time the movie came out.
No.
Wasn't he?
When did it come out?
I think it came out in 87, didn't it? Early 87. Well, wait, when did Tonga Kid and King Tonga start teaming?
Body Slam came out in 1986, November 21st.
And when did Tonga Kid come back?
Around that same time period, but he was working as a Tama.
My point being that, like, it's kind of an interesting mix that you have Piper, that the movie is built around Piper and Tonga Kid against Barbarian and Tejo Khan, managed by the recently departed Lou Albano, in a movie that also features a guest appearance by Ric Flair.
And Freddie Blassie. And Bruno Sammartino.
Bruno was WWF at this point.
Yeah, Alexis Smirnoff. We also had an appearance by Charles Nelson Reilly. We can't forget that. So that is a really fun movie. John Astin's in it. Billy Barty's in it. It's like just an odd cast. But it's a really fun, campy movie.
It is. Why am I forgetting the name? Oh, Smilac. Dirk Benedict as Harry M. Smilac, accidentally inventing the rock and wrestling connection.
Yes.
Do you realize it's weird how so this movie's like 2 years out of date? That's like, oh, the big hook is that it's rock and roll and wrestling.
Yeah.
That's the big hook, and then. But it's fun. But I wonder if politically, or well, you know what? It's Piper though. It's Piper who went to work for Don Owen while he was working for Vince.
Yeah, Piper don't give a shit.
I'm saying for Vince. Yeah, so this movie was probably nothing.
Yeah. Now, also on October 18th, we talked about Crockett running Philadelphia. Well, here's a Spectrum show, and they drew 15,986.
And also, it's worth pointing out, in 85-86, they did not usually draw that great at the Spectrum because they usually sent them bad shows.
And so this is Piper. So
and Hogan.
We had Ian Hogan. So we had Dick Graham and Lord Alfred Hayes on commentary.
Oh my God!
And we had Jimmy Hart doing the guest on Piper's Pit, where Hart came out with the Red Demon, proclaiming him as the bodyguard for the night. So Piper quickly got him out of the ring, and the Demon decided to abandon Hart. Piper didn't allow Hart to tie his hand. Basically, Piper did the same thing as he did on the Superstar show. So and Orton got involved, so Piper started taking him out. Now listen to this Spectrum car. Corporal Kirshner beat Tiger Chung Lee in 12:07. Then we have Pedro Morales going over Steve Lombardi in 6:11. Billy Jack Haynes fought Hercules to a 20-minute draw. And 1986.
If only you could see his face right now.
Yeah, Coco Beware defeated the Red Demon, who's played by Bob Bradley, who was subbing for the recently departed Jimmy Jack Funk at 5:35. Then we have Macho Man defending his Intercontinental title against the Honky Tonk Man, beating him by countout in 7:04.
That's Babyface Honky Tonk Man.
Yeah, Babyface Honky Tonk Man, which we'll talk about that a little bit later. Hillbilly Jim defeated Mr. Fuji in a tuxedo match at 5:06.
You know, I know about that program, but I don't remember what actually led to it.
I don't either. Kamala went over Lanny Poffo in 3:35. And your main event, Hulk Hogan over Paul Orndorff by countout in 16:23. And the stipulations were Hogan could lose the title by disqualification. So, yeah. And Hogan Orndorff against strong, strong program.
Now, I don't think we went over the Civic Center card.
No, we didn't go over the Civic Center card. We'll go back.
Compare the lineup.
Yeah, let's compare the lineups.
And this is so originally.
All right, we got the Midnight Express going over Tim Horton and Don Kernodle.
Oh, you don't want to give the original lineup? Or...
Whatever. Yeah, because, I mean, the original lineup was changed so much. Yeah. Then you had the Colossus of Crusher going over Valiant Murdoch and Wahoo.
So, yes.
Brad Armstrong subbing for Magnum T.A. going over Jimmy Garvin by DQ. Magnum T.A. and Jimmy Garvin was the feud at the time. In fact, Magnum T.A.'s last match was in Greenville, South Carolina on October 13th, and where he beat Jimmy Garvin. Yep. So that was the feud.
Well, he had Manny won off the Nikita feud the month before.
Yeah, Nikita won the feud, too. Manny Fernandez pinned Hector Guerrero. Ricky Morton and Robin Gibson defeated the Andersons by DQ. And then the Dusty Dillon match. And of course, you know, Flair wasn't there because he was supposed to be in Japan. Well, he was there as part of the whole angle deal, but, you know, he had a match because he was supposed to be in Japan. So, yeah, I think I would have went to the Crockett show.
I don't know. That Billy Jack Kane's Hercules match sounds interesting.
Yeah, oh, for many reasons.
Can I ask, why did Hercules stop being good?
I think once he left Watts, where Watts demanded that he be good.
But he was good before that.
But I think maybe he got when he went babyface in Dallas, where he replaced Billy Jack Haynes, no less. It just wasn't a good fit. Then he went to Florida and had that deal with Wahoo, where they got into a fight with him in a locker room, and he got fired. And that's where he went to work for Vince not too long after that. I mean, I think he's a guy that just. He got too big in more ways than one.
Well, yeah, because he was known for being a great bump taker, and then once he got bigger and bigger, probably didn't want to do that as much.
Well, Bill Watts, you know, if you watch that Mid-South stuff, you know, in late 84, Bill Watts was like praising Hercules to the high heavens. He was saying Hercules is going to be, you know, one of the next great future stars in this business, you know?
Well, I mean, if you look at him early on, I mean... He's this big, muscular guy, really good worker for where he was so far and, you know, in his experience. And, you know, good bump taker, not, you know, pretty decent charisma, not a bad promo. Although I don't know why he thought bragging about how much steroids he takes was a good idea for a promo.
No.
But he just kind of lost it around like 85, 86.
Yeah. Now, speaking of guys that were lost, the Honky Tonk Man. There's a thought going around the Honky Tonk Man being a major flop as a babyface that they may have to turn him, but another revelation is the fact that in his match against Jake the Snake Roberts, the fans are firmly in his corner, so they're thinking of turning him babyface, Jake's corner. This one is especially tough for Vince McMahon because this was his baby, according to Dave Meltzer. It was a total bomb. Total bomb. And you can see why. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah. Why Honky Tonk Man in the first... Like, well, why Wayne Ferrett? Well, he already was Honky Tonk Man. So why Honky Tonk Man, though, to be your fake Jerry Lawler? Why... Like, there's no one else you could have... tried to get?
I really don't know.
And because that's what he's doing. I mean, if you watch, you know, those early babyface Honky Tonk Man squash matches, he has the strap so he can pull the strap down. He does the fist drop for his finish. I don't know what they're thinking. I mean, he, you know, good promo, but there's not that much there. Like, why is this the guy you're having to be the... I mean, because that was his role. It was to be fake Jerry Lawler. So why this guy? Like, when there are so many different people who are good at that style, I mean, why... Yeah, you just brought in Coco Ware. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I know. I guess there's one thing that they decided was wrong with him to be fake Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, he has that one minor difference. He's short. No, I mean, we all know what the deal is. So.
I never thought of this before. Think about this for a second. You bring in someone to be your Memphis style babyface. At the same time, you are bringing in Coco Ware, the much more talented guy who broke in with the other guy you're bringing in. Right?
Yeah.
They broke in together. Yeah. Him and Honky Tonk Man broke in together. But no, Honky Tonk Man is the one that gets the push. And Coco didn't even get a push.
No, nothing. No.
He's brought in as basically a job guy. I mean, kind of. I mean,
well, there was like a story about that people were upset at how much they were jobbing him out, so they finally gave him wins against like the small, you know, the lesser known guys. That's crazy. I mean, the fact that you bring him in just to steal him from Watts, basically is what you did. I mean, that's what the reason was.
Yeah.
Just to stash him away.
It's not like Watts was even pushing him that hard either.
No, he wasn't, which was stupid. But and the story here is this is the beginning of Jake, you know, really starting to get over the babyface too.
Yeah, no, I'm trying.
And that picked up, you know, more and more as it went along. And by the end of the year, I mean, he was pretty much full blown.
And of course, then was Honky Tonk Man the official turn or?
Yes, the guitar over the head was the official turn.
But he had kind of been a babyface already.
Yes, on house shows.
And also when he faced Savage, he was kind of the de facto babyface.
Yeah, exactly.
When was the Hogan thing with Jake?
January 87, December 86, in that time period.
Okay, so I guess that's when they really make the decision for sure. How familiar are you with the whole with all the legend behind the snake pit with him DDTing Hogan and all that?
I mean, I know it happened.
But you know that it only aired in a couple places and that whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was watching the one that aired everywhere, and I'm thinking that it may be that it's actually the same segment, because like you see, it seems like there's like it ends where the other one could have gone on.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that one day. You have never seen it, have you?
No, I haven't.
Because I think it was only the places where they did the house show program, right?
Yes.
So Providence, those type places.
Yeah.
Although there's a clip of the Providence match that's online, though, because that did air like on the Event Center, but not the. I've never seen the Snake Pit, but Jake. I mean, it was only a matter of time, though, after seeing how things ended up with him in Mid-South, that he'd be a babyface.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, on that note, let's get our plugs in real quick. What you got going on?
Oh, let's see. Figure four, going to have kind of part two of the thing I started last week about. First, I did kind of some Hogan stuff from a deposition he did in the Big Show boxing lawsuit thing, and I'm going to kind of continue with the Big Show stuff. But Hogan stuff, if you didn't see it, it's him telling all the Hogan stories under oath. So you have Hogan swearing that he's telling the truth, that he quit wrestling to work on the docks. And in this version, it's Eddie Graham that calls him. And no one confronts him in person. It's not Jack Grisco. It's not Terry Funk. Eddie Graham calls him. But so stuff like that. And what else? You know, I got my stuff. You know, SEScoops.com, MMAnews.com, Daily Updates at the Observer site. Now we're collaborating a little more on those. But, Saturday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Fighting Spirit, I guess a little less than 2 weeks, new issue with an article on Eddie Guerrero. Guess that's it right now. May have a new podcast up my sleeve. Don't know where it would be yet, but I'll let you know when we do. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. If you feel like it, look, you know, on Amazon, if you want to do my Amazon referral thing, I have it at tinyurl.com/BixAmazon. And if you shop at LuchaShop.com, if you want to save 10% on your order, use the coupon code Bix. Okay, do your thing.
Yes, follow me on Twitter at KRISZELLNER. You can follow Bix at David Bix. New Exile on Bad Street coming up. We'll be recording this week, and it's going to be an interesting show. Because it spawned off a Twitter debate fairly recently about wrestling crowds. And I got two guests booked. I'm not going to say who they are just yet.
Well, I guess I'm one of them then. Yeah.
No, you're not going to be on this one. But it's going to be an interesting show, definitely. And that should be coming up this week. I'm going to try to get Exiles out weekly again. I already got 2 weeks worth booked. And we'll go from there and see how it goes. So I'll go ahead and say this. A Puerto Rico show is coming. Another chapter of the Puerto Rico story with Bariqua. So be on the lookout for that soon. But, of course, you know, we do these shows every week. So check them every Monday. Next week, we'll have the Hell in a Cell reaction show. So be on the lookout for that next Sunday night. And that's about it. Oh, on Pro Wrestling Only, I have a thread going where I rewatch the indies, going through my old U.S. indie stuff from 2001 and all that. And watched Best of the Best 1, the CCW tournament from May 19, 2001. So go check that out on the Pro Wrestling Forum and hear my take on the first ever Jay versus Mark Briscoe match. And Phil Schneider posted the old DVDVR Road Report there, which that's a total blast. So go check that out. And not much else added to that. Definitely we're glad to have Bruce Mitchell on this show. I mean, that's a great get because Bruce is a guy who, I mean, I've been reading him forever. And that was my first time I actually got a chance to talk to him. So that dude's just, he's great. He knows his stuff about the Crockett scene. So we'll definitely have him back on again. But other than that, we'll get on out of here because right now I am watching Evolve 50. And I tell you, when we're recording this show, they're actually showing a Ricochet Johnny Gargano match from China because Sami Zayn is appearing live from the crowd and he can't be on WWN. So
even though every fan shot it on their phone last night at the end of the show and it showed up on YouTube.
Yeah, but you know how it is.
I know.
But anyway, we'll leave on that note. And so for David, for Chris, say so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
I got long sideburns and my hair slicked back. I'm coming to your town in my pink Cadillac. I'm just a honky tonk man.
He's a honky tonk man.
I'm just a honky tonk man.
He's a honky tonk man.
I'm just a honky tonk man.